Tonight on The Download, comedians Keegan Michael Key and Jordan Peele, Alinea co-owner and restaurateur Nick Kukonis, and newly elected 33rd Ward committeeman Aaron Goldstein. And now, here's your host, a man who broke the world speed record for getting to the free break room donuts, Justin Kaufman.
When you get an all-staff, you gotta move, right? You gotta move. Because then all that's left is the fritters. Nobody wants the fritters. I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed. It's not going to be a Fritter Tuesday. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate your time. We've got a great show lined up for you. And we don't usually put these shows together around themes, but I got to say that tonight, there's a nice little through line brewing. All of our guests are change agents, people who've excelled in their field by offering change, being the alternative, disrupting the status quo. First up, the new ward boss in the 33rd Ward. 33rd, you say? That's Dick Mell territory. The longtime Mell dynasty was turned upside down in the March primary, so there's a new committeeman in town, and his name is Aaron Goldstein. Goldstein may be a new name to politics, but not in legal circles. Aaron was on a defense team for former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. We'll talk about what one does when they take over the reins of a political machine. Also tonight, the new feline action-adventure movie Keanu hits the theaters this weekend. The stars have a great Chicago background. We'll talk with Key and Peele about their Chicago roots, changing the game at Comedy Central, and moving on to the big screen. Another man who's changing the game, Alinea Restaurant's Nick Kukonis. Nick is the co-owner of Alinea, Next, Aviary, and the new casual spot Royster. He's the man who's also behind Tock, a new ticketing system that changes restaurants from not just good food, but great entertainment. Kukonis and his partner Grant Ackett are up for Outstanding Restaurant at the James Beards, which is coming up next Monday at the Lyric, and Nick's going to join us tonight. All week, Pete. All week, we're going to have different chefs on who are nominated from here in Chicago, nominated for a James Beard Award. And how about Dennis Rodkin's new walking tour? It's all about sex and how this city has changed with it over time. Essentially, you know that Jamba Juice you love? Well, it's probably once a porn shop. That's essentially the walking tour. That's what we're going to find out. Also, change is in the air at the UC. Who stays, who goes, and who will be around next fall for both the Hawks and the Bulls? Sammy Panjanovich will be here to break it all down. It's a good show, right? I think it's a good show. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. And production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, let's get to it. Let's start with the carryout. This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here today's top story is the Blackhawks bounced in Game 7 by the St. Louis Blues. This after an up-and-down season where the Hawks at times looked like they were ready to repeat, and at other times looked like they were ready to go back to Canada or wherever they're from. But they fought till the end like they always do, and keep your head up, Hawks fans. We still have all the best players in the NHL locked up for multi-year gigs, so the window is not only still wide open, it's stuck. Like painted over stuck, like an Albany Park apartment, where the guy just can't push it down. It's just always open. Ugh. Mayor Emanuel said he had nothing to do with the reassignment of outspoken principal Troy LaRaviere. He says he doesn't get involved in personnel matters, and if you believe that, I got a Lucas Museum I'd like to sell you. Parents protested the move today, and CPS came out and said it was reassigned because of several improprieties, including misuse of CPS equipment. When I hear that, that makes me think he climbed up the playground slide. And if he did, you just can't do that, right? You can't. It's like you're breaking society's rules. Hey, speaking of the Lucas Museum, all of this moving and shaking, changing and rearranging is because of what a judge could rule? Did we not vet this before? Let me guess. Laquan McDonald happened, and Rahm has become the O.J. Simpson of Chicago politics. Yep, he didn't get pinched for the first deal, so he's getting pinched for something smaller. Makes sense? Wait, the presidential primary, it's still going on?
Tonight, a big almost Super Tuesday. Something tells me Hillary and Trump will win, but yet will still somehow be in a tight race. Doesn't it feel that Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders are just applying the Hack-a-Shack theory in this election? Foul the front runners before the play even begins? It's going to be something to watch this summer at both conventions. I say get a front row seat, but that's pretty close. On the GOP side, just think of the cologne alone, just wafting right at you. Super rich Jacquard Noir for Trump, and I'll bet like a Stetson Sierra for Ted Cruz. Not Stetson, but like a Stetson Sierra. The city of Chicago announced today that 50 million tourists visited the city in 2015, and 48 million of them stood in line for Geno's East Pizza, or blocked the entrance of the Lego store, or then got some Garrett's popcorns and put their feet in the Millennium Park face fountain. That's a lot of feet. Gross. Taste of Chicago announced today their summer music lineup. You got The Roots, The Decemberists, Billy Idol, and the Isley Brothers. Talk about something for everyone. Yeah, something for everyone to complain about as they fight hordes of people to get standing room on the Metro back home. Ah, the taste of Chicago. Apple announced iPhone sales are down for the first time since 2003. I know, just make the phone bigger. If that doesn't work, make it smaller. That's what they've been doing for like 10 years. And now it's time for the download's personal reminiscence about what Prince's death means to us. You know, Prince shaped me as a teenager. We're out of time. Oh, we're out of time. Sorry. Well, that's been the download's personal reminiscence of what Prince's death means to us. In weather? Come on, weather. Be normal. We're not asking for 80, and we don't want 40. Just the 60. It's late April. 60. In sports, we already talked Blackhawks, but what can you say? At least they made the playoffs. Bears. Bulls. Oh, sorry. I got crappy sports teams stuck in my throat. How about our Chicago baseball teams? It's only been 20 games, but the White Sox and the Cubs are atop their divisions. No, scratch that. Top their leagues. The Cubs are getting more attention, but check out the White Sox who are underway right now in Toronto. Last night, they came from behind to beat the Blue Jays. You go a long way in the respect game by taking a series against Toronto in Toronto. The Cubs start a six-game homestand that starts with the Brew Crew. Arrieta to pitch on Wednesday, which is almost becoming a citywide holiday. Is Jake Arrieta the best pitcher the Cubs have ever had? I'd have that conversation. I mean, what, Fergie, Maddox, Sutcliffe, Remlinger? I mean, go down the list. It's almost time for Draft Town 2016. The Bears have the 11th pick overall. The amount of mock drafts out there kind of ruined the whole thing. Each draft has the Bears picking someone completely different, which goes to show you the Bears are pretty bad at a lot of different places. But they got a ton of picks, so we'll definitely see what GM Ryan Pace is all about. I hope they shock the world and go for a punter. With the 11th pick, a punter. It'd be awesome to have the best all-world punter. We'd root for fourth down. We'd marvel at the hang time. We'd go crazy every time he pins a team inside the 20. Yes, punting, Bears, football. We could bark. And every time he kicks, we bark. And finally, a new census study says that the millennial generation is now the biggest generation of all. I'm sorry, let me read that in a way that millennials will understand. What up, you big all-time baller? You big, you see news? Thumbs up emoji, smiley face emoji, airplane emoji, Rihanna emoji. Man, work sucks. I deserve a promotion. HMU! Well, that's the carryout for April 26, 2016. If you need a fork, let me know. I'll throw in a few, because let's face it, these plastic forks, they just don't get the job done.
I do a pretty good millennial impression. Gotta say, right? Spot on. Spot on. Coming up, Aaron Goldstein, the new committeeman for the 33rd Ward. At 8 o'clock, we're going to talk with Key and Peele about their new movie, Keanu, and their improv roots right here in Chicago. It's a download on WGN. Stay with us. All right, coming up here, we're going to talk with Aaron Goldstein, the new committeeman for the 33rd Ward in the city of Chicago, about taking down the Mel dynasty. Dick Mel, he beat Dick Mel. But first, we're going to talk with the news. Rob Martyr is here. Rob, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you. You know what? I want to talk. I had such a great vacation. Pete did as well, because we don't actually vacation together, but we took vacation at the same time. So coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, we thought it'd be fun to talk about our vacation in a new segment we're calling Tell Me About Your Vacation. 312-981-7200.
I like the title.
Tell me about your vacation.
Sure.
I think there'd be a lot of great vacations, you know? Maybe we'll be inspired. So I want to get your... So think about that, Rob, about what... It couldn't, doesn't have to be the vacation you just went on, the last one. It could be just best one. So we'll get
sounds
to that.
Good.
I'll ask you about that a little bit later.
All right.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, Key and Peele, Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Both great comedians. The new movie Keanu comes out this weekend, but they also have Chicago roots. Keegan-Michael Key was on stage at Second City. Jordan Peele was touring. He also had a great show with Rebecca Drysdale, who was just on the show at I.O. back in the late 90s. So we'll talk with them about their brilliant career, and now a movie career, and then also their Chicago roots. And then Nick Kokonis, who is the co-owner of Alinea, who's up for best, they're up for best outstanding restaurant, James Beard's, which is coming up here on May 2nd. So we'll talk with Nick about Alinea, which is slated to be reopened here. It's been under renovation since January, and it's opening, I think, in the next week. So we'll talk with Nick about that. Well, this past month's Illinois primary saw big wins for the presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But it also, wins for Kim Fox and Juliana Stratton, not to mention the two Senate candidates. I mean, it was a straight-up sort of Illinois primary. But last month's primary also included local races, specifically committeemen. And there was no bigger shock than the race for the 33rd Ward committeeman, a seat that was held by longtime power broker and former alderman Dick Mell. Mell, of course, the head of the notorious political family. That includes his daughter, Deb Mell, and his estranged son-in-law, Rod Blagojevich. Dick Mell was running against somewhat of an upstart, Aaron Goldstein, a lawyer. Didn't have much political credit to his name. He'd run for office before. Although some may recognize the name as one of the lawyers on a defense team for Governor Blagojevich. These storylines are kind of intertwined, Aaron. Goldstein ended up winning the committeeman seat by just over 50 votes, which has to be one of the biggest upsets in recent Chicago political history. Aaron Goldstein joins me now in studio. Aaron, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. In the 33rd Ward, we call 50 votes a landslide. So,
it's amazing to think of the 33rd Ward, especially at the committeeman seat, without a Mell. You know, Dick Mell had held that for a long time. What made you run against Dick Mell?
So Dick Mell had the seat for 40 years. And committeeman is a pretty unknown position, and it used to have a whole lot of influence. It still has influence, but the influence it used to have is patronage. And that's why the Mell family, in particular, and the machine in general, really like that
position.
They
like that position, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll make one objection. I'm in no way a new boss. the whole point of this run is to sort of get rid of that, not be a boss anymore, be part of the people. But what a committeeman does is it's an unpaid position that does a lot of things. It appoints election judges. So the people that are sitting at the polling place, making sure all the numbers are correct, making sure mm-hmm. the electronic numbers coordinate with the paper numbers, making sure the right people are voting, the ones that are actually in the ward, registered to vote, those types of things, they're appointed by the committeemen. In our last election, the 33rd Ward, the aldermanic election, there was a 18-vote difference to get a runoff. And originally, it was going to be a runoff. Then all of a sudden, all these absentee votes came in,
right.
And they went overwhelmingly for the incumbent, Deb Mell. And I was a poll watcher. I saw what happened. And there's just shenanigans over and over and over again. And some of it's incompetence. Some of it's underhandedness,
shady. Right.
And someone, you know, many people approached me and said, you know, this committeeman position is very important as far as making sure we have fair elections. So that was a big thing. Something also near and dear to my heart is judges and slating candidates. So a committeeman in the Cook County Democratic Party, which a committeeman is part of, they slate judicial candidates. And for the most part, it's all backroom deals and favors for one person, and people who aren't even qualified are slated. And once you're slated, you got a real good chance of winning the election. Once you win the election, we're pretty much stuck with you as a judge. And I see these judges every day, and we're stuck with incompetent judges, people who are not qualified because of a backroom deal. And then the judges, the judicial candidates, give the party anywhere between $30,000 and $40,000 so they can get slated. That's not what our judicial system.
What you're explaining is the nuts and bolts of what we know to be the political machine, or when they say the machine, quote unquote, the machine in Chicago. This is sort of the guts of it. If you're ever confused about what that means, this is a lot of what it has to do. Why? I mean, I understand why you want, but I mean, are you looking? You say you're not the new ward boss. Are you trying to change the party from within? I mean, is this a progressive move to say, you know what, out with the old kind of patronage and the way that the machine worked, and in with a new kind of democratic politics in Cook County?
I mean, I couldn't set it any better. I mean, absolutely, that's what we're trying to do, and that's what I want to do as committeeman. And the thought is there's always upstarts from the progressive angle to try and change from outside of the party and outside of the system. And that's fine, too. That has its place. But here we have this system already set up. And we have a system in which why not just run for it and take it over from the inside? We have an infrastructure. And the party is only going in a particular direction because of the committeemen, because of the people in the party. So why don't we change those people? And there is a move on the Northwest side. There's many candidates that won the last election that are a completely new direction. And I plan on forming an alliance with them and really changing.
Well, I mean, the Democratic machine is by no means dead. I mean, just because you beat Dick Mill, there's still a lot of people in it that want it to stay the same way. How do you see yourself, you know, as a new guy walking in the room in that back room being like, hey, guys, I'm Aaron Goldstein, and this is how we're going to do things. It's going to be hard to get footing.
No doubt. But, for example, in the 39th Ward, Robert Murphy, he won his election against one of the Lorino family. So we calculated somewhere between his ward and my ward about 80 years of machine rule in the ward. So he's now won that committeeman race, and we see eye to eye on many things. So that's one level. Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who's in the 35th Ward, he just won his aldermanic race, and now he's become the committeeman, and he's moving the party and moving, you know, things in the city council in a progressive direction. So we do have these candidates. These are all neighboring wards that's sort of this progressive movement within the party. And yes, there's 80 committeemen, and we're three to begin with, but I plan on forming a lot of alliances so that we can move the party in a particular direction. But even within the 33rd Ward, I have the ability, by appointing election judges, make sure we got those fair elections. Within my ward is the 6th Sub-Circuit, and I have the ability to have a much higher power in slating a judge in the 6th Sub-Circuit. So I want to work with all the people in the 33rd Ward so we can get someone that's representative of our community and qualified. So we can do things just within the 33rd Ward. And just the fact of me winning and defeating Mr. Mel just by itself, I think opens the floodgates. And I think people see, hey, I can do this now.
A lot of this has to do with the changing demographics of the 33rd Ward too. I mean, the demographics have changed. You're seeing different people in the 33rd. It's not sort of I would say ethnic white as it was, you know, or the way that Dick Mell had sort of, you know, held that space. Things have changed up in the 33rd. It's not the same ward that it was, say, 10, 15 years ago.
They have changed. I mean, the 33rd Ward is such a beautiful place. It's the most diverse ward in the entire city. I mean, we speak like several languages, several ethnicities, several people from all over the world. It really is a beautiful place. You go down Kedzie Avenue, and it's so great. You have a taquiera to a Middle Eastern restaurant to a sushi place. I mean, it all within a block. It really is wonderful. So, I mean, I guess the demographics are changing, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's the reason why there was a change.
How do you think you won this? How did Dick Mill lose to Aaron Goldstein?
I mean, I think there are a lot of things. I think the election, the last municipal election, really upset a lot of people, and they saw an election potentially stolen. And they saw that a committeeman had power to change that. And arguably, if you had a different committeeman, you might have had a different result. So that was a very important thing. And I think just change. And some of my biggest supporters within the ward were people that have lived there their entire life or much of their entire life. And they said, I'm sick of this. I want to change. Some people didn't even realize that DeCamillo was still the committeeman. So there was a lot of difference, but it wasn't necessarily just new people saying, oh, I want the new person, because a lot of the new people in the ward didn't even know who Dick Mell was. So we actually had to educate them on who he was and who I was and what my message was.
Well, I mean, for you, I mean, you're new to politics. You did run for state rep not too long ago, but you're somewhat new to politics, but you're not new to the machine because you were on the defense for Governor Rob Blagojevich. I mean, the second trial, the one that he ultimately went to, you know, to prison on, you were part of the defense team. Talk about, you know, your experience with the sort of Chicago machine and everything close up in the courtroom.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fascinating experience. Both those trials, it was quite fascinating, and I did learn firsthand. There were many things I learned. I mean, I learned about the dynamics of the family. I learned about how politics works every day. And I think one of the issues within the Blagojevich trial was it was seen as the crime of the century. And Patrick Fitzgerald said that Lincoln would be rolling over, in his grave. And as we see things happen after, and if we look in retrospect to what happened before, this man was talking a lot and talking in a very profane way and talking in a very offensive way. But if you look at the totality and all of politics, you begin to wonder, like, is this the crime of the century? Why is this person gone after and other people not? So that really got me curious. But politics has always been in my blood, and I've always had an interest in policy and
why?
Actually changing.
Why? What brought you to the political table?
Oh, I mean, it starts as a young kid, an influence from my mother and father, who we always talk politics, and she influenced me to make a change and to actually care about people. And the question is, how do you make a change? And there's millions of ways to do it. And one way I always thought was advocacy, and that's either advocacy in the courtroom, advocacy within policy and politics and government. And I saw this as an opportunity to really change things. And you can sort of be disillusioned with the entire process and say, I'm done with it. And I sort of understand that. But the politics and government are still going to keep moving. And you can ignore it. You can run away from it and say, it's the worst thing ever. And I'm not going to be a part of it. You are now absenting yourself from the process. And now we have one less decent human being to be part of that process. And over time, I really, saw that and wanted to be part of the process. And quite frankly, after going through the trial, I knew I could do it. I mean, I could be in politics. I could be in government. And I know I can be successful at it.
Aaron, Chicago is very unique when it comes to politics. You have so many, you're now a committeeman. There are books and novels and historical documents and textbooks that are written about Chicago politics. I mean, there's so many different things that not only have to do with the city, but they influence the way this country works. What does it mean for you to be involved with that now? I mean, do you see it as, okay, I'm going to change the way it's done? Or do you see it as the beginning of a career for you in something that's so rich in history, some of it good, some of it's bad, but the idea of are you essentially a lifer politician that's taken over in the city of Chicago?
I mean, for life, I'll be in politics and be involved in government and trying to make a change. As far as what my next steps are, it's very simple. I want to do a good job as a committeeman. Whatever happens in the future, it's gonna work itself out. If people want me to do something else, that may move me in that direction. But I really came into this job as trying to do a good job. Fixing our elections, getting good judicial candidates and having them win, and really increasing the participation of voter turnout and just civic participation. Let's have meetings, once a month and talk about what's going on in the community. Let's increase the voter turnout. The last election, in my election, we had over 13,000 people in the 33rd ward come out to vote. I had people, and I'm not saying it was my all the way at the end of the ballot race that got people out, but I had people actually come up to me and said, I am here just to vote for you. We had a presidential race, a state's attorney's race. We had all these other races, and this inspired people, and that's exciting. So I just want to be part of that movement, part of change, and inspire other people to really make a difference.
Well, all politics is local.
Yes.
The local committeeman for the 33rd Ward is Aaron Goldstein. Aaron, thanks so much for coming in, and good luck with the task of being the committeeman the 33rd.
Thank you so much.
Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Nick Kokonis. He is the co-owner of Alinea. They're up for Outstanding Restaurant, the James Beards, which will be at the Lyric Opera on May 2nd, which is Monday. Also, a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk with Crane Chicago Business real estate writer Dennis Rodkin about his passion, his walking tour, the sexual history of Chicago. It's great. It's essentially a tour of all the places that used to be something doing with sex here in the Loop. And I think about that all the time. I think, like, when I walk into the corner bakery and I'm like, this used to be something else. And Dennis will tell us what it used to be. There's a lot of seedy stuff. State Street, Hubbard Street right here, where all the clubs are that you walk into and you're like, oh my God, $19 vodka. Yeah, this DJ's great. Justin Bieber's here. Well, before Justin Bieber was there, it was a gay brothel. So we'll talk with Dennis Rodkin about his walking tour, which starts back up this spring. And also Sam Pinjanovich will be here. Talk about the terrible news of what's off-season, Blackhawks off-season. That's a terrible story. It's like, that's one of those where it's just like, thumbs down. Tough lot to be bouncing the first round. Seven-game series, and, you know, it's tough to go up against the St. Louis Blues, who really have an inside shot here to get to the Stanley Cup after knocking off the defending champs. So we'll talk with Sam about that. And the Chicago Bulls. I hate watching the NBA playoffs right now. Am I the only one who's just like, I can't understand how the Charlotte Hornets, Atlanta Hawks, Indiana Pacers, Toronto Raptors, Boston Celtics, how any of these teams are in and the Bulls are out. So we'll talk with Sam about if there's going to be any accountability and what the team may look like in the fall. But coming up now, we're going to talk about one of my favorite topics, Chicago comedy. Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Now, here's the rub on this. We taped this a little bit ago, right before my vacation. We went over to the Treehouse animal shelter. It's a cat shelter in Wicker Park. Because they're doing the junket. They were in town, and Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele were here in Chicago to talk about their new movie, Keanu, which opens up this weekend. So what they do, you know, they don't want to go around to everybody and do interviews, so they set up shop. And because it's a movie about, it's an action-adventure featuring cats, kittens, they set up shop in a cat shelter. So for the visuals, because most of the people, you know, like a Janet Davies or from ABC or Bill Zwecker from the Sun-Times or any of the people who cover, you know, the celebrities, essentially. You know, that's the setup. You want that cool shot. And then you walk into the room and there's just a bunch of cameras there and they're just getting the reaction shot. You just say, so tell me about your movie. And they do their thing, right? So that's what we did. And so I was like, well, can they come over to the studio? They're like, no, they can't. They can only do the junkets. I'm like, it's not really set up for radio. You know, we're not going to see the cats. So we did it. I went over there and I stood in line with all the other guys and I got 10 minutes because I know Keegan. I know Keegan and Jordan from when they were here in Chicago. And it was really crazy because you walk into the room and there are like 15, 20 people in there. There's like makeup artists and there's the videographers and there's the person who's just like staring at her watch saying, you got 10 minutes, you know, and then the next person's up. So, but they saw me and they're like, no, that's fish out of water. It's an improv Justin doing here. I'm like, well, I got a show on WGN. They're like, oh, cool. I haven't talked to him in a couple of years. So they were there, but it was really interesting because they were also there with Jason Mitchell. Jason Mitchell's in the movie, and Jason Mitchell, fascinating, is Eazy-E from Straight Outta Compton. Like the movie Straight Outta Compton, the guy who played Eazy-E, Jason Mitchell, he's in Keanu. So he's sitting there too. So I'm like, wow, it's Eazy-E. That's awesome. So essentially I had the conversation with them at the Treehouse, and the conversation was about Chicago, their time here, about improv and how it helps them, and the training that they got here in Chicago helps them with their career, both on Key and Peele and on the new movie Keanu. So take a listen. Tell me about the difference between writing sketch comedy, which you guys, obviously with Key and Peele, it was a big deal, and writing this movie. I mean, what's the difference, not just with writing, but shooting it and the idea of producing something longer than sketch comedy?
The big difference is you have to be aware of the big picture of the movie. You can't do you can't have a scene go so crazy that mm-hmm. when you start the next scene, people are like, wait, no, hold up. You were in outer space.
Right.
In that last scene. So you it's hard because what we've trained ourselves to do through this sketch show is just as quickly as possible go boom, 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 and then you're watching a complete Looney Tunes level, like insane,
right.
Heightened reality. So this was like, we got to pick the tone. It's got to be heightened, but it also has to be grounded. It has to be consistent. and it has to be good.
What I loved about your show and is you could tell that your roots in Chicago, but it was a complete, these were complete sketches. You know, they weren't sort of, you know, funny character and then on to the next thing like we've seen sketch comedy on television before. You guys do have a beginning, middle, end. Does that change when you're doing a movie? I mean, do you have to think a little bit differently about a scene as opposed to, you know, a sketch, a beginning, middle, end?
Yeah, because you can't just, it's not just, I think some people might think, oh, we're just stringing sketches together.
Right.
And but the more important thing, as Jordan said, it's the thread. The thread is the most important thing. So then, and also, a sketch can exist on its own in any way you want it to. It can just be silly, or it could have some social meaning. In a film, every scene has to be helping the story. I mean, because that's the, for me, it's something I always notice when I watch a movie. I'll see a movie and go, why is that scene in the movie? Like, you know, I don't even know what that's, what's the information I'm learning from that scene? Whereas what you want, that should be the ideal, is that you're trying to figure out in every single instance, oh, now I'm getting this information. Now I'm getting this information.
Right.
And of course, in the beginning of the movie, you're setting up a bunch of promises, and then you have to deliver on those promises at the back end of the movie. And you don't have to worry about
that. Do you guys like that? I mean, do you have a preference? I mean, do you like working in that kind of narrative style where you're, you know, working over an hour and a half or a 2-hour big script as opposed to sort of sketch?
They both have their advantages.
Yeah, sure.
They both have things that are great about them. It's great in sketch that you get to, you know, we got to be, you know, in one day we could be aliens.
And then, 18th century revolutionaries. Yeah.
You know,
right.
That's interesting. That's like kind of like having a holodeck. The movie thing is a bigger payoff when you see the final product because you can get caught up in it. And, you know, the characters don't go away. You get invested in the characters. And that's awesome.
Let me ask you, both of you, I mean, working, you've been in films, you've done films on your own, you've worked in television, that kind of thing. Together, this is your first major motion picture. What does that give you in terms of freedom? Like to work together, to know each other, to be Key and Peele, what does that give you that you don't get on other sets that you're, you know, playing different characters?
You get a shorthand. You know, that's part of it is that we understand each other in ways that I think other people don't. You'd have to have as long of a relationship as we have. And the other thing is there's never a sense, well, I mean, first I'll give you this example. The shorthand will be sometimes we can, it's as if we're calling football plays. So we'll go, you remember Jane? I'm on the button hook on the wall. Sit around on the Razor 6. Eagle, 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 call it eagle. Hot, 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 oh, Omaha, Omaha, Omaha. And then we go and we know what that means to us. So it's like three beats of Megan. So if it's Megan and Andre, like those two characters in the sketch show, I don't know what we're going to do. I just know it's three beats of Megan and Andre. We go on stage and we just do it. And it just happens. Because there's a shorthand and then there's like the subliminal shorthand. Then the other thing is we can lay hands on each other. Like you meet other actors, you don't know where you stand yet. And are we gonna? How physical can I get with that person? Whereas we know we can go just about anywhere with each other. And then the third thing, which is kind of, it's just more pleasure or joy, is just we almost know exactly what each other's threshold is.
Yeah.
So I'm actively trying to make him laugh. And he's actively trying to make me laugh. And there are times when you break. It's like a fencing duel. But when we do that to each other, you, the viewer, see us having fun. There's another level of us having fun.
Well, there's definitely, I mean, the banter, the dialogue you guys have in the movie, you could tell that exactly. I mean, there's this sort of like, you know, one-upmanship. Jason, I want to bring you in. You know, working with these guys who inevitably are in every scene trying to make each other laugh. You're a serious actor. I mean,
right.
you know, straight out of Compton, the other movies that you've had. I mean, you haven't been in that kind of scenario. How hard was it to work with actors who are constantly trying to break?
Oh, man, it was tough. I mean, they got me a few times. But the beauty in it is kind of, like, because my character is still a dramatic dude. You know what I mean? So it brings beauty to it, and it has its own level of comedy when I don't break. You know what I mean? So I'm actively doing that by not breaking. If it makes sense, I'm fighting back. You know what I mean? So it's like, they're just not trying to make me crack. I'm trying to make them crack too by just sitting there with this face like, are you serious? You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, it's different too. I mean, if it's on stage and you guys are on stage, a crack smile or something gives a nod to the audience. But when you're shooting a scene, it just can't happen, right?
Right.
You're going for realism.
Right.
You're going for a sense of we're grounded in this. You know, Jordan has said before, there's this thing where you go, if Jordan and Keegan, as real humans, were transported into New Jack City, the movie, what would that be? In real life, if that happened to us for real, what would happen?
Right.
And how would we behave? As opposed to just saying, it's not a high concept movie. So we're in real dangerous situations, and kind of the style of the film harkens back to older films, Raising Arizona, Thelma and Louise, Midnight Run. So there's this sense where there's a comedic element that's extremely present, but the bullets are real.
Right.
And the blood is real. Right. Yeah.
Let me ask you about your time in Chicago, because both of you spent time here, Second City, I.O. How does that inform what you do, especially in a movie like this? I mean, how much improv is used, but maybe not just about, like, you know, you learned improv. What did your time in Chicago do for you when making a film?
I mean, one lesson we learn, a principle sort of developed by the late Del Close, is, you know, truth in comedy. there's an emotional component that you have to, no matter how crazy a character you're playing, there has to be an emotional truth to it. And the same thing with this entire movie. You know, we feel like the character Keanu actually grounds this movie, because this is a believable, you know, there's no amount of money that you could offer me that will make me walk into this gang's club and start mouthing off and pretending to be a badass. No amount of money. But if you told me my kitten was in trouble, that would get me there. So something is only as funny as how grounded and real it rings to people. If people watched this movie and felt like, nah, you just wouldn't do that, then we'd be dead in the water.
There's a moment-to-moment phenomenon. That's what improvisation is, right? The fact, and also, think of, if you look at the movie, aren't Clarence and Rel, the lead characters, aren't they improvising as they go? I think it permeates everything we do as writers, because to achieve the goal they want, which is to get the cat back, they have to yes and this foreign culture they've just walked into. So they have to improvise. They have to yes and. They have to not deny the reality. And as they're creating the reality with each other, they're already in peril. So it's like, right. I'm not going to say no. Once it's done, they have to continue to accept and heighten the reality that they're in. They have no choice.
Well, I think I speak for the entire city of Chicago when I say congratulations, guys. Great movie. Keanu opens on the 29th. Yes. Great to see you guys.
You too.
Congrats
you too,
on all your success. Jason, nice to meet you. And nice thanks for taking some time.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks.
There you go. Key and Peele. Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Live, that's in the treehouse cat shelter. I don't know if you can hear the meow once in a while in the background there. Meow. It's probably a much better visual, you know, for when that piece plays on ABC with Janet Davies. There'll be cats crawling all over. Meow. But for radio, you get poignant moments. What improv means to me. Meow. And there you go. Key and Peele, the movie Keanu, comes out this weekend all over the country. Go see it. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All this week, we're featuring some of the Chicago talent that are nominees for the James Beard Awards. The prestigious culinary awards feature chefs, restaurants, food journalists, cookbook authors, you name it. And it's going to be right here in Chicago come Monday, May 2nd. One of the big categories is Outstanding Restaurant. And Chicago is well represented with Alinea, a restaurant that continues to top the best of lists from all around the world. The two frontmen for Alinea have been busy. Chef Grant Ackett and restaurateur Nick Kokonis are renovating Alinea, opening up the casual spot Royster, which just opened a couple weeks back, and continue to run Next and Aviary. Joining me tonight, Nick Kokonis. Nick, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
So let's talk about, are you excited about the Outstanding Restaurant? I mean, it feels like you know, I was just telling Pete, our producer. I mean, I was on the plane reading GQ or something, and they're like, "Oh, you know, you're in there. You know, best of restaurants. You're here, there." Does it get old for you guys that you're always at the top of these lists?
No, I mean, I don't think so. And this one, I think what people don't realize is that you cannot be nominated for the best restaurant in the United States for the James Beard Foundation until you've already been open 10 years. Mm. And so, you know, I think that they have the best new restaurant category, which we won with Next in 2011. And Alinea was nominated for that back in 2005. And then you have to wait a whole 10 years before they kind of go, okay, you know, you're not a flash in the pan. You're right. Going to be around for a while. And so I think in this case, it rewards not only an innovative and popular and cutting edge restaurant, but also longevity, which in the restaurant industry is always a trick, I think.
It's unreal, too, to think about. I mean, what does it mean for you to have a restaurant that's been open as long as Alinea? To be open 10 years, that's a feat in its own right.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it for us, although I visited a restaurant in Kyoto once that was open for about 500 consecutive years. So I guess in one sense, we're just getting started. Especially now, in this day and age, I think the half-life of restaurants is, you know, 5, 6, 7 years or something like that. And tastes change and people are fickle. But, innovative restaurants, innovative dining experiences, and creating ways of making people not only full but also stimulated, happy is always great.
This is a big year for you because you're renovating Alinea. You took a couple months off to change the building up on Halsted. That's about to be done. I mean, coming up next week, you guys will be back in business. Talk about what you're changing, what we can expect from Alinea.
Well, you know, Alinea, the word itself is a typographic symbol, a pilcro. It means the beginning of a new train of thought. And about 6 months before our 10th anniversary last year, Grant came to me and said, "What should we do for the 10th? And we got to talking and we sort of said, "I think we should rip it apart. You know, if we're really about innovating, if we're really about pushing forward, something that we designed in 2004 is not going to feel modern in 2020. So rather than just, you know, paint the walls and right. get new drapes and put in some new chairs and carpet, we actually took the wrecking ball to the entire interior of Alinea, ripped it down to studs, and rebuilt it from the ground up. New HVAC, new plumbing, everything. So I think people are going to be shocked when they see it. I think our old customers are going to walk in and the few people that we've sort of taken through there as it's almost getting towards completion, we're pretty jaw-dropped in that absolutely nothing is recognizable.
It's interesting because your career has been one that has a lot of change in it. I mean, you were in finance before you got into restaurants. You've done a lot of different things. You know, you have a great quote on the website about if you feel like you know what you're doing, something's wrong. talk about, I mean, your relationship to change and how important it is for you and Alinea Group.
Personally, I've had a different career about every 10 years or so. And I don't know that was by intent. It's just I was always kind of a restless person in that way. And I sort of look at all business as the same fundamental problems. And so I always just find interesting people to work with and then go about, you know, waking up every day and tackling those problems. And so, I was a derivatives trader. I started out as a floor trader down here at the Merck, trading currency options and built that into a business. I've worked on several different websites, and I'm working almost full time now on Tock, which is our booking system for restaurants. It's in use in 7 countries already. And, you know, when I met Grant, it was just like meeting Miles Davis when he's 28. You know, he's playing totally different music and he's clearly a genius in what he does. And I never had an intention of opening a restaurant, despite my Greek last name here in Chicago. but I met this extraordinary person, and a year later, we opened Alinea together. And, you know, for us, it's always been about the process and about challenging each other and our team and our staff. And we always feel like we don't run focus groups. We don't really ask the customers what they want. We feel like if we create something new and different and compelling, then we'll find our own audience, and that's always happened. So that's what we're trying to do again, and we're kind of throwing all the old greatest hits away, and it will either look like the smartest decision we've ever made or absolutely the dumbest one.
Well, I mean, in the restaurant business, I mean, when you get a hit, and you have a hit like Alinea, you have a hit where, you know, even with you guys, I mean, Next, there is this I guess, this resistance to change because you got the hit and you want to keep doing this. So it is almost going against the grain when it comes to innovation and creativity in this business.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think we all, one of the phrases that we use internally is that at some point, you know, any design feels like your grandparents' living room. You know, when your grandparents built their house, I'm sure it felt very innovative and cutting edge. And then 30 years later, you go in there and it doesn't feel quite so new anymore. And so I think a little creative destruction is always important. And I think it's scary. But I also think that's when you, as a creative person, feel the most alive, right? So when the outcome's uncertain, that's when things are most interesting and you tend to do your best work.
Now let's talk about Talk, because Talk is what you guys have developed and innovated, the idea of a ticketing system for restaurants, which, you know, when you brought out for Next and for your restaurants, you know, was brought a ton of fanfare, to some critique, but the idea of changing the way that we do restaurant reservations, which has always had its problems, and people who still use it know how hard it is, but to change it from some sort of like calling up and being able to, you know, book a table at 6 o'clock to selling tickets to the restaurant.
Sure. And so we started out with tickets for Next, but now it's evolved into something, you know, much more broad than that. And what we like to say is you book an experience. So within any restaurant, you know, every restaurant serves food, but like the great ones have a couple different experiences. So you might have an a la carte, you know, meal, like in the front dining room, like we do at Royster. Then you sit at the chef's counter and maybe you get a 5-course chef's tasting. You might also have private dining. Right now, if you go on to a typical restaurant booking site, you say, oh, I want 4 people on Saturday at 7, and it says, oh, we don't have anything within 2 hours of that. Your next step is to pick up the phone and call, and you've got some harried person at the front door who's trying to seat people and also answer 3 phones at once. And it just feels like something that's, you know, from 15 years ago. And what we say is you'd rather, you know, swipe than dial. Like, why not show people what's available, the full inventory, have them click a couple swipes on their phone and book it, whether that's a prepaid ticket, as it is at some high-end restaurants like Alinea, or if it's an ordinary reservation, it's just a lot easier to do it that way.
It's like performance, right? I mean, it's like theater. I mean,
yeah,
it's the same concept.
Every other form of entertainment, this is the way it works. Let's be clear, I love what we do, but no one needs to eat at our restaurants. It's a luxury, it's a form of entertainment, and it's one that's culturally embedded, you know, for hundreds of years all over the world. So I don't think it's a big leap to book things this way. And we seated, using Talk, we launched in July, we seated over 506,000 people already in 7 different countries. So it's working, it's web-based, it's not an app, you don't have to download anything. And ideally, the customers shouldn't even know that they're using Talk. It's just really a tool for restaurants to more easily manage their bookings and give their customers, you know, greater hospitality.
Is there any pushback to the idea that food is entertainment, or almost like the staunch sort of restaurateurs of the world who saying, no, food is food? I mean, is there any pushback to the idea of changing the customer's perception of what food versus entertainment?
Well, I think, look, I mean, if we're fortunate, we get to eat 3 times a day, right? And so there's all of these social and political issues that are very real that are wrapped around, you know, food, because you need it to survive. You need it for satiation. And so I feel like when you say it's entertainment, that could be offensive if you're saying, well, there's people starving in Chicago as well.
Right.
And that's certainly something we're very, very aware of and sensitive to. At the same time, you know, calling it entertainment in that way actually doesn't necessarily diminish it. I mean, there's an incredible number of different kinds of entertainment. And when sometimes people say, well, it's really offensive that Alinea costs, you know, $300 per person. And then meanwhile, you know, they might pay $300 to go see, you know, a sporting event
right.
or a concert or something the very
right.
next day.
Right.
Sure. So it's really just a matter of choices and what people feel is the thing that makes them happy. And I don't think it's a negative at all. I think that's just part of what we as humans do. We try to, you know, take whatever form of art that people are dwelling in and seeing how far it can go, and whether that's a great athlete or a ballerina or a singer, it doesn't really matter.
Well, you guys, you and Grant are pushing the boundaries and seeing how far it will go. I mean, this winter you had 2 pop-ups. You did pop-up experience in Miami, one in Spain.
We've been busy, Justin.
So, I mean, but you branched outside of Chicago. I mean, Alinea has meant so much to Chicago just with the idea of bringing just the high-end dining to this area and having, you know, people fly from all over the world to experience this restaurant and then experience Chicago. Why branch out? Why get out of Chicago and start to work in different cities, different countries?
Yeah, I mean, two reasons, really. The first is that we shut Alinea on January 1st, and we had 62 employees that were looking around going, okay, what are we going to do for the next four or five months?
Right.
And the second is that we wanted to take that opportunity to learn something ourselves. And so Spain is really the cultural seat of this style of cuisine, this experimental cuisine that started, you know, probably 20 years ago or so. You know, Grant goes to Spain. He's been there every year for the last 11 or 12 years. And he's like a rock star over there. I mean, they really, really elevate their chefs to a different level there. So we just had an opportunity to go there and take our staff and have a cultural exchange, really. And I'm going to say it was really hard. We got 52 EU work visas. You can imagine the bureaucracy involved in, right. in getting 52 temporary employees over there. The sponsorships that we needed to make it work financially, lodging for 52 people for 6 weeks. And it was all worth it. I mean, only four of us spoke any real passable Spanish. So it was a trick to get it all done. And then we came home for a week. And then we did the very same thing in Miami, down in Mid Beach, in Miami Beach. And then we did the pop-up here in Chicago for 3 weeks. And so all of these were sort of experiments that we ran to see, you know, if we could do them, to learn something about the cuisines in these various locations, to work with other chefs, and really to give our staff a chance to experience something outside of what we do every day.
You know, you guys, I mean, obviously expanding the restaurants that you have. I mean, you talk about Next, Aviary, the pop-ups, Alinea. That's obviously something that takes a lot of work to do. But you also have to manage staff. I mean, we saw the executive chef from Next, Dave Barron, leave. He's leaving for L.A. Talk about that part of the job where you have to continually make sure you got the right people in the right places, because the chefs and the servers and the people that work with you guys are sought after. I mean, we're seeing them, you know, the family tree of the Alinea group become an open restaurants in different places.
I call it the Alinea diaspora.
Right.
I kind of, anywhere that I go now, I was just in New York, I go into a restaurant and I see two familiar faces there. And to me, you know, rather that being a negative, it's really a testament to the culture that we've built over this time, to the ability of our teams to train people, to instill in them a real great sense of hospitality and discipline in the kitchen. And then, you know, it's a natural thing if you work in this industry to want to have your own opinion, your own point of view, your own creative urges and create a restaurant. And so, you know, just going around Chicago, Ileana Reagan used to work at Alinea, and Curtis Duffy was our opening sous chef at Alinea, and he has Grace now. And, you know, pretty soon you got the Loyalist opening with John Shields and Karen Shields opening. So, you know, those are all chefs that worked, you know, daily in the kitchen of Alinea right here in Chicago. And so the challenge for us is obviously to keep bringing in new talent and training them. And, you know, hate to use the sports analogy again, but it's not unlike running one of those teams, I think, in that, you know, you have some core folks that you keep, that sort of anchor your team, and then you look to constantly be going to your farm league and bringing in new folks.
All right, so this is the big weekend. You got the James Beards on Monday, and then the weekend, I'm assuming, is big for all the foodies that come in from all around the world. What does it mean to have this in Chicago, you know, your hometown, where you guys are from, where Alinea is set up? I mean, is it a lot of pressure on you guys to show everybody a good time?
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you a funny story, and I don't think he'll mind me telling you, because he's a friend of mine, but Will Gadara, who's the co-owner with Daniel Hum of Love Madison Park in New York, which is perennially in the top 10 in the world, and kind of our brothers from New York in a way. Like, we're very open with them and have done a collaboration with them. They're great friends. And when I found out a couple of years ago that indeed the James Beard Awards were going to go next year to Chicago, it would be last year, and I kind of leaned over and I said, oh, don't tell anyone, but next year you're going to be coming to Chicago. He kind of looked at me and went, nah, I mean, because like, we're in the Lincoln Center in New York, which is absolutely the center of the universe to any New Yorker. And he just couldn't believe it. Like, he just wouldn't believe it. And then when they confirmed it, he was like looking at me like, oh my God, what are we going to do with our derby party? What are we going to do with all the traditions that we've built? And I just said, you're going to have to ride your horse into Chicago, you know? So it's huge. I can't, you know, just like the NFL draft coming here for the food industry, this is the big one in America. And, you know, we have, you know, chefs and restaurateurs and press and writers all built around the industry coming in this weekend and enjoying, you know, the restaurants here, enjoying hopefully some weather if we get lucky. Yeah. And, you know, we threw three gigantic parties last year and it was great. I mean, it's just a great opportunity to show people from around the country what we do here.
Well, the restaurant Alinea is up for outstanding restaurant from the James Beards. Nick Akonis will be there and hopefully you'll bring it home for Chicago. Nick, thanks so much for taking some time out and congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you so much for everything and great to be with you.
All right, it's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9:30. Oh, hate to have this conversation, but, you know, we got the big O, offseason. You know, the Chicago Blackhawks lose last night. Now we turn to contracts and what's going to happen, who's in, who's out. A conversation we thought we'd be having in June. You know, we'll also talk about the Chicago Bulls. Sam Panionovic is here. We'll talk with him coming up after the news at 9:30. Well, Dennis Rodkin's up now. He's a frequent guest here on WGN. He joins Steve Bertrand regularly on the Wintrust Business Lunch, talking real estate and hot property. But Dennis is here for a different type of hot property. Dennis Rodkin moonlights as a tour guide in Chicago to bring you the sexual history of Chicago walking tour. It took a hiatus for the winter, but it starts back up on April 30th, and he's with me now in studio. Dennis, great to see you, man.
Hi, Justin. How
I love you? Having All right, let's. Usually we talk real estate, not geek it out about, but sex. Okay, we'll talk sex, too. Yeah. Geek out about sex.
Well, they're kind of related, right?
They're very related.
During the week, I write about real estate porn, and during the weekend, I talk about sexual real estate.
So how did you get involved in this? What drew you to the stories of Chicago when it comes to sex?
It's from being a journalist in Chicago for so many years, you know, and these stories, I'm writing about a building, I'm writing about a family, whatever it is, and these stories bubbled up, and I would think, wow, this family had some weird sex things going on, but it doesn't fit into the story I'm writing. Or something really crazy happened in that building. So they all go into a file, and at some point that file gets so thick that you start to think, well, geez, you know, and as I said to you once before, it's fun because it's sort of like performance journalism. When I write a story about a piece of real estate, somebody off in the distance reads it. But in this case, these are stories. Some of these stories kind of make your skin crawl because there are some weirdos I write about. And some of these stories really make you very, very happy because they're about people who move the boundaries of sexual expression. So for me to be there and stand in front of you and tell you that story, it's fun for me, too.
And just to set the record straight, I mean, you're not taking people to sex shops and saying, look at this, look at that. I mean, it's not a explicit, you know, sort of tour. This is really about the history and some big issues when it comes to sex, but also sexual, like you said, sexual freedom, sort of speaking out on sexual issues. There's a lot that happened here in Chicago that people just don't know about.
There's a lot of it. We had the first sexual education curriculum in the public schools in America in 1913. And for only one school year, because it got shouted down by parents. But it was a very progressive idea that all these children, you know, 1913 Chicago, it was a lot of children of working class immigrants and things in the Chicago public schools. Your parents knew nothing whatsoever about sex and certainly weren't going to teach you how to do it. And one of the problems was you were then really likely to get venereal diseases. So one of the reasons to teach sex ed in the schools is to help you with your sexual hygiene, which was a really far-sighted idea in 1913. And the woman who created or who spearheaded the curriculum for the Chicago Public Schools, Ella Flagg Young, got shouted down. Parents said, no way are you talking to my kids about this. The Chicago Tribune editorialized, you know what? These kids are probably better off than their parents. Actually, they probably know more and will be healthier. But still, parents said, get out. And just a year later, she was out as the head of the CPS, which wasn't called, which didn't go by that name then. But we started it. You know, it started here. There are so many of those.
So, you know, Chicago, obviously a big city and a liberal city in the way that, you know, big cities are, New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco. But does it reflect that in the tour? I mean, is it a liberal sexual identity here in Chicago, or is it more Midwest uptight, kind of buttoned up sort of value?
That's interesting. Kind of. I think if I were doing this tour in San Francisco, it would probably be a lot shaggier. I haven't done the research in San Francisco that I've done here, but a lot of the story here is people moving the bar a little bit at a time. I keep talking about people who moved the boundaries of sexual expression and gender expression. We have a lot of that. We have some very important transgender people in Chicago in the 21st century. But a lot of that is going an inch at a time. But some of it was truly groundbreaking. Alfred Kinsey, the Kinsey Report.
Right, of course.
In the 1930s, his first research trips outside southern Indiana, outside the university he worked for, were here in Chicago. And I've actually found the hotel where he stayed on his very first research trip, which is just, you know, it's just kind of cool to be able to say not only he walked the streets here, but this is where he stayed.
This is the Travelodge and where he stayed.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So, a little bit conservative, but also... Moving the boundary.
So, I mean, when you say it's a walking tour, obviously mm-hmm. you got to stay in a certain area, and I'm assuming
right.
it's the Loop. But, I mean, are you looking at, I mean, is the kind of thing like, look right there, breasts. That statue's got breasts. Or is it more, I mean, are you talking about, like, picking a building and saying this happened at this time? And, I mean, tell us, how do you sort of operate the tour?
There are some statues downtown with breasts, but amazingly, I let the audience kind of find those on their own. No, we walk around. Yeah, so a lot of this is, like, what happened here in 1912 is. What happened here in 1940 is. I mean, I kind of had to force it into one location.
Right.
You could do a bus tour. I would like to do a bus tour. Start at the Leather Museum up in Rogers Park, about 6900 North. Go all the way down to the apartment in Hyde Park where Hugh Hefner laid out the first issue of his magazine in his apartment. Also about 6900 South. Do a bus tour, but I had to stuff it into the Loop. I don't yet have
the money
for a bus. So exactly. No bus yet. So some of the stories I've kind of dragged into the Loop. Like I take you to a place and... There's a story about Mies van der Rohe way out in Plano, Illinois, but I do it at the Federal Building, that kind of thing, to make sure that I can tell all these stories in one place. But you walk around with me for 2 hours, and we talk about a couple of dozen different weirdos.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about some of the areas. I want to talk about State Street, sort of seedy State Street. And then also Hubbard has a long history of a seedy background, you know, where all the sort of expensive restaurants and noisy nightclubs are.
And a couple of them, the places are still there.
So we'll talk with Dennis Rodkin. His tour, The Sexual History of Chicago, starts back up on April 30th. Do you go to your website? Where do you sign up?
Sexualhistoryofchicago.com. And there's also a Facebook page, but all the dates, it's every other Saturday morning. So the dates of those Saturdays are on the website.
You can also just, you know, do knock on the back door of the adult magazine shop.
And say,
Dennis told me to show up. Don't do that. Don't do that. All right. We'll talk more with Dennis Rodkin after the break. Stay with us. Appropriate music here for Dennis Rodkin. The Sexual History of Chicago Walking Tour is back. Starts back on April 30th. You can find out more at sexualhistoryofchicago.com. Is that right? I got it. Dennis Rodkin, of course, works for Crane Chicago Business. You can hear him regularly talking real estate on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand. So, Dennis, I mean, in the break, you're kind of talking about, you know, where this kind of comes from. And it's interesting because conventions played a big role in sort of the developing the seediness of this town.
Conventions, railroads, the fact that we were the crossroads of America, right? So as I'm traveling, first of all, the hobos are passing through like crazy and they're passing venereal diseases around. And there was a lot of fighting venereal diseases in Chicago. But also, I'm coming in from a little town in Iowa, a little town in Ohio, wherever it is, by train to Chicago. And I can, you know, get my freak on in 1930 in downtown Chicago. So it's...
Well, let's talk about 1930 is a great place to start because, you know, the South Loop yeah. plays a huge role in Chicago's seediness. You talk about the brothels and the sort of the culture around the mobster scene that took place in the South Loop.
Well, and even before that, really from the 1880s on, there are whorehouses of different kinds and different locations. When you like from Van Buren South, State Street was known as Satan's Mile. There were dirty bookstores. There were gay massage parlors. There were whorehouses at different times. There was a publishing company that tried to help you deal with all this. There was a publishing company, Max Stein Publishing, that published books like Sex Facts for the Married and Husband Know Thyself, so that you could clean up the problems you created with your weird sexual proclivities. And all that stretched south on State Street. The Everly Club, one of the most famous houses of prostitution in America ever, and also apparently one of the most fabulous, with fountains and eating off china, that sort of thing. That was on Dearborn, right where the Hilliard homes are, or eventually were. I don't know what that building is called now, but this was considered the most amazing whorehouse in America. When a prince of Prussia toured America and they said, what are you going to do in Chicago? He actually said, I'm going to the Everly Club.
It's like the Disneyland.
Exactly, yeah.
Midwest. Not just there. I mean, obviously, there's so many different areas, and you'd cover this in the tour. But, you know, you've got Satan's Mile and State Street, but then you've also got Wells Street, which has a huge history.
Wells Street has a history. You know, the funny thing is, one of the stops on the tour is where a house of prostitution, a whorehouse, was in the 1860s on Wells. Wells now, you know, just a piece of the loop, was the far western end of downtown Chicago. And so there were whorehouses and other things going on. It, for a while, was known as Little Cheyenne, because it was this ragged western frontier full of filth. And so in return, Cheyenne, Wyoming, called its sort of den of iniquity Little Chicago.
It's a little back and forth.
Yeah. But we're not dirty, you're dirty.
But that, I mean, prostitution plays a big role in the tour, I'm assuming, because there, you mentioned whorehouses, but also just, you know, I think of the 1960s, 1970s Chicago as a place where there was a lot of sort of street walking.
Yeah, a lot of street walking. But, you know, the high point of the 1960s in the sexual history of Chicago, I think, is the rise of Cynthia Plastercaster, who was a rock groupie, still alive, still in Chicago. She was a rock groupie who decided that the way she could get to sleep with rock stars was to make plaster casts of their penises. And on the tour, I have much more specific information that I don't want to.
You don't want to give it all away.
I don't want to give it all away. But that, to me, is sort of, you know, you think of the 1960s, you think the hippies pouring up and down the streets, that sort of thing. And here's this one woman who totally into that scene decides, well, the way I'm going to make it happen, I'm going to get myself invited into this rock star's room or these rock stars' rooms and make plaster casts of their penises. And you can still, by the way, you can still find those online. She has, Cynthia Plastercaster has a live website where you can see the 75 or so plaster casts she made.
All right. Well, let's talk about Hubbard Street, because Hubbard Street too, you know, has reformed itself. It's gentrified in the way that you've got this tremendous nightlife. Yeah. I mean, the nightclubs, the restaurant, the high end restaurants. It's a place that people are coming. If you're down on Hubbard Street at midnight on a Saturday night, I mean, you'd think that this is, you know, there's billions of people waiting in line for all these things. But there's a true seedy history to this street.
Yeah, there really was. You know, and that's as recent as the early 1980s, before we thought of the place called River North as River North. It was just kind of over there. Hubbard Street especially had dirty bookstores, is really the only way to refer to them. Door after door after door. There are one or two left. There's still TJ's,
right?
And it's kind of funny.
There's one right next to Paris Club.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Just wondering, like, is that a new Melman joint? Do I walk in? What do I do? This is so real.
And how do you, the thing I don't understand, I mean, more power to them that they've managed to exist, but how do they persist? One of the ones we go to on the tour is in the South Loop, or one of the sites we go to in the tour was a place called Weird Harold's in the 1970s. This guy, Harold Rubin, had a dirty bookstore, and his distinction was you didn't only go in there and buy porn or look at porn, you could go in the back room and with your own camera shoot a picture of a topless woman. So this was, you know, because at the time you didn't have internet porn, right, and things like that. So he went out of business not too long after, but you would go in, you used your own camera, and a woman took off her top and you took her picture, and then you go home and, you know, that's what you've got. So that's the 1970s.
They should have done it more like they do with the Easter Bunny at the mall, where he uses his own picture, his own camera, and then you can get 4x6s, you get 8x10s, different packages, right?
Justin Kaufman's new business, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. So, but I mean, you think about it. I mean, how much of this stuff that you're talking about, sexual history, remains? I mean, because one of the things about Seed, you know, like, is it still, it stays underneath it. You just mentioned some of the stores are still on Hubbard. But I mean, how much do you, I mean, if you really look closely, are you still seeing remnants of seediness in the South Loop or seediness on Wells Street or the like?
You know, it's hard to. I think, you know, we're in the internet era. I think so much of that has disappeared from the physical world onto the internet because it's more private, right? I mean, I can't even imagine what it would have been like to go into some of these porn theaters on State Street and things like that and enjoy yourself there with a crowd of other people. Online, it's a whole lot more private. So I think a lot of it has sort of been washed over by that, and also just by the boom in Chicago. You know, everything and an awful lot of places are far more fabulous than they used to be. We just discussed Hubbard Street, River North, the South Loop. It used to be that the three neighborhoods around the Loop, the South Loop, the West Loop, and River North, were all pretty grungy,
right? Because the West Loop was the sort of Skid Row.
Yeah.
Yeah, the flop houses.
And
yeah.
Now they're all as nice as they could be.
I mean, even Rush Street, if you think about it. I mean, Rush Street now is kind of known as, even though you date yourself a little bit because it's moved down south to Hubbard Street, but Rush Street used to be a nightlife spot. But there's a lot that was happening on Rush Street that was beyond just drinking beer in a nightclub.
Oh, absolutely. After these mics are turned off, let's talk about 1985 on Division Street, things that I went through. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure that's part of the tour, right? Where you give the, now let me tell you about Dennis Rodkin.
Oh, yeah. I totally get into my own personal sexual history, which is about, 30 seconds long.
All right. The tour is the Sexual History of Chicago Walking Tour. It starts back up on April 30th. You can find out more information at sexualhistoryofchicago.com. Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business covers real estate. These are the stories that he couldn't get into his columns over the years, but he brings them to you. It sounds fascinating. I'd love to come down and...
You got to come, Justin. It'll be a lot of fun.
All right, Dennis.
I'll make you glad you came.
Thank you so much for being here. Good to see you, buddy.
Thanks.
Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Third period. Last game in the playoffs, too. Oh, take me where the hockey players face off down the rink. And the Stanley Cup is all filled up for the champs who win the drink. Now the final flick of a hockey stick and a one gigantic scream. The puck is in, the home team wins the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey,
good old
game,
hockey game
is the best game you can.
Oh, man, like I said, it's tough to have this conversation with Sam Pinjanovic, WGN Sports, as we talk off-season instead of the second round of the playoffs after last night's a heartbreaking loss to the St. Louis Blues as the Chicago Blackhawks, the defending champions, are out of this year's Stanley Cup playoffs. Sam, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I teased it. Might as well get right into it. First time in 7 years that the United Center won't have a playoff game in the month of May.
Whoa!
For either sport. So I don't know what to do with myself because I have spent Mays and Junes, and you've got two teams there. You got the Bulls and the Hawks.
Yeah, right.
Both teams will not play a May playoff game for the first time since 2008.
That's crazy. And so in 2008,
the Bulls missed the playoffs, and I believe the Hawks missed the playoffs too.
I was going to say.
Or they might have made it and lost to Detroit in the first round.
I hope the United Center can get a hold of, on short notice, Disney on Ice and get them in there for a quick run.
I've got friends in the elevator business over at United Center, swear to God. And they're excited because every year they're like, man, I got the Hawks, I got the Bulls. We're going to be working through June.
Yeah.
No, not this year.
I'm sure there's an economic story in there somewhere about
all the guys who do the floors are now going to work for Luna.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, man, can we install some wood floors for you?
So it's strange to me. 2008 is the last time. And, I mean, both teams had failures of seasons. I'm tired of hearing that the Blackhawks had a great season because they finished in third and lost in the first round. To them, that's not success. When your marketing brand is one goal, and they'll be the first ones to admit this.
Yeah, they'll tell you that.
This year's a failure. And the Bulls, That's a monstrosity failure.
Okay, well, let's start with the Hawks because, you know, they had such an up-and-down season. They had times where they had streaks. There were a lot of, you know, Patrick Kane had a huge streak. There was also the streak where they won, they won 11 in a row, 12 in a row. But they also showed times where they were just down and out, where they were getting beat by obviously inferior teams. They were inconsistent. A lot of what we sort of set up at the beginning of the year was, well, maybe they don't have the talent. They shipped Brandon Saad. They shipped a lot of other people out. You know, and brought people together and they piecemealed a team. But all along, the storyline was maybe they don't have enough to compete for a defense of the Stanley Cup. And it kind of proved true.
Yeah, they had lost guys in years past. But I think this departure from the 2015 Cup winning team was the most responsible, most experienced group of guys they lost. I mean, to lose Johnny Oduya and Patrick Sharp. I mean, those two guys, would you like to have them right now? I mean, they're freewheeling and dealing in Dallas right now. Sharp looks like he's 5 years younger, and Oduya is on that blue line. They're so solid in Dallas. So you lost some guys. Brandon Saad was a power forward that you just don't have right now. I mean, Richard Ponick was playing alongside Taves and Kane. So I think the depth as a whole just wasn't there. I also think mental and physical fatigue goes into trying to repeat to win the toughest trophy in sports. I mean, it's been done, I think, one time since 1990, and that was the Red Wings in 97, 98. I think that's right. So the hardest trophy to win in sports is the Stanley Cup. It's even harder to win it 2 years in a row. And I looked at the numbers. Since the lockout was lifted in 13, Chalmerson has played 362 games.
Yeah.
Seabrook, 361.
Right. It's amazing.
I mean, it's just the mental and physical toll.
It did seem that, you know, you were seeing much more sort of fatigue on the defensive side. They were playing, obviously, shorter rotations, but it was... You know, last year I think we were talking about Duncan Keith for he was MVP because he logged so many minutes. They tried that same sort of formula. They're playing really just three defensemen, and you could tell there were some of the plays on the defensive side of, you know, not being able to clear the puck, turning the puck over.
It was turnovers and penalties.
It was amazing to me. I mean, even in the last goal, that was just a straight up. I mean, I forgot who it was because
Gustafson was
Yeah, and then it was like, sliding what are you doing? But you saw that throughout the whole series. It wasn't, you know, that the Blackhawks were necessarily outplayed, but they definitely were shorthanded or just didn't have it on the defensive side.
Yeah, Patrick Kane had talked about this after Game 7 in St. Louis about that they kept putting themselves behind the eight ball. They kept falling into holes. In the series, they fell in a hole. They'd fall down 2-0 in a game. They'd fall down 3-1. Eventually, it was just too much to overcome. And yet, at the same time, your captain doesn't score a goal. The best player in the world scores one goal, and you lost in Game 7 in the third period on the road. So that shows you just how close they really were. Depleted as they may be, as exhausted as they may be, and it's mental and physical, and you'll hear now exactly in the next coming days and weeks just who was hurt and what happened. But it's a lot of hockey over a short period of time, and... The breaks didn't go their way. I mean, they hit double post twice in the same series.
Yeah.
They lost Game 4. Ladd hit left-right crossbar. And then Seabrook in Game 7, post-to-post. That doesn't happen in a series.
It is interesting. I mean, because as much as it's terrible for the Blackhawks, for Blackhawks fans, I mean, it really is a two-month difference. They're going to get this, you know, they're now effectively, they start a little bit of a vacation or an off season where, you know, they get a little bit more rest because they have been coming off these sort of like late June after the parties, late June. And then they're back in.
Oh, so, party through July. You don't get it twisted. They win the cup in the middle of June. So, that thing's going around the world.
Let me ask you, I mean, off season, already talking about sort of, you know, we are still at a point where there's salary cap issues for the Chicago Blackhawks. The big players are signed up, but do we have the same sort of turnover that we had in years past?
You won't have the amount of players, but you'll have significant players. And as you mentioned, when you have guys like Kane, Taves, Crawford, Seabrook, Keith, Hossa, Chalmerson, and Anisimov locked up for a handful of years, you have to now balance that check. But you can't pay everybody millions of dollars.
Right.
So now it's guys like Andrew Shaw, who made $2 million this year. He's a free agent. Dale Weiss, who you just traded for at the deadline. You traded a really good player in Philippe Dano. Probably not going to have money for Dale Weiss. You know, you've got down the road, you know, Richard Ponick. Are you going to be able to afford him? And then Teuvo Teravainen. Can you afford him? Because the Panarin bonus kicks in now. Because Panarin had X amount of points. He was top 10 in forwards. he's going to get like $1.5 million in bonus that they weren't expecting. And the worst part of the Hawks situation is the Brian Bickle contract.
And still,
that's where that bites him, because that's the worst contract that they have on this team. He's going to make $4 million next year and probably not even play in the pros. And they buried him this year in Rockford,
right?
But that money still counts.
That's tough to have that kind of money and on a player that didn't even.
Yeah, I mean, you thought you gave him the huge contract after the 13th.
And he's a name. I mean, he's a name, but you see this a lot. You see it more in hockey, where players, they just lose their step or something happens. They fall out of favor with the organization. They're gone, but the contract still remains.
I forgot to mention Andrew Ladd, who they traded for. Right. They got rid of Marco Dano. So Ladd's probably gone. I mean, he's going to sign for $4 or $5 million. So you don't have room for everybody, but you've got to find guys. This is where the scouting department comes in handy, and your player development. You get guys that are 21, 2, and 3, bring them up, hope that they can turn into something. But the goal is, with these guys locked up, you're not trying to win in 2 or 3 years. You're trying to win this year. You're trying to win now.
Sam Panjanovic is our guest tonight from WGN Radio Sports. Okay, so you know what? Let's take a quick break. We come back. We got to talk about the Chicago Bulls.
I brought my shovel to bury the Bulls.
I feel like we haven't really had the post-mortem on the team.
No.
Because they did that so quick, and they got in, they got out.
On a Friday.
They news-dumped it against a ton of other sports news. So we'll continue the conversation with Sam about the Chicago Bulls up next.
Basketball, Chi-Town, WGN Kaufman.
Who gon' stop me?
It's a download here on WGN.
Is that an original?
That was an original, and I have to say that was, we were going to be playing that. I thought we'd be playing that into late May, Memorial Day, you know, where it's just like, game six tonight. The Cleveland Cavaliers and Chicago Bulls.
No,
will this be Derrick Rose, Kyrie Irving? Oh, God.
No, instead you got the Raptors and the Pacers. Grr.
I've been saying it the whole night. I mean, watching NBA basketball first round action is excruciating. There is no good basketball
it's
happening.
Bad.
There are bad teams in the playoff. The Miami Heat and the Charlotte Hornets. Come on. You know, so I mean, talk about this. I mean, what happened for a Chicago Bulls team to not make it into the Eastern Conference playoffs?
Do you have, we need at least an hour. I'll give you the shortened version. I was playing Operation the last hour, so I've been operating on that poor little plastic guy. The leadership in general just completely went south. And you had a guy in Jimmy Butler, good player, solid player, maybe a max contract player. That's what he got. I don't know if he's worth every penny, but he's up there. All he did all year was talk about becoming a leader. And he was vocal about wanting to be the leader. Well, then lead the damn team. He comes out 25 games in, calls out the head coach, says he's not coaching hard enough. And then, you know, he's not playing well, and he's blaming injuries. And then there's the Derek thing, and then Joakim Noah gets pulled out of the starting lineup for Pau Gasol. And you just had a lot of egos, and a lot of them got truncated this year. And the decision to fire Tom Thibodeau remains one of the worst decisions in the history of the franchise. I mean, you fired a coach that went to the playoffs 5 years in a row, regardless of if you didn't like him or not. The guy never missed the playoffs in the East.
And to be honest, I mean, what they tried to do was to do this move, not unlike they did in Golden State, where, you know, they're at a point where they're a playoff team, but we need to make a move to a finals team. And Fred Hoiberg was supposed to do that, but we've seen this regression. Does that at all impact the direction of this team? Because they have guys on this team, veterans, max contract here, mid-level guys here. The whole point to be competitive with the Cleveland Cavaliers to get to the at least to the Eastern Conference Finals. Now with this move where they don't make the playoffs, are we talking rebuild?
You have to do something. You have to shake it up. If I can do so, though, before we get into this, I have a clip. I brought a piece of audio in my pocket, and I just gave
look
it to Pete. So this is why you should be upset, because it's not just about missing the playoffs. This was the expectation that was placed upon this team. Pete, go ahead and let that run.
Derek, there have been people in the national media back here, back row, that have thought that this team, because of health concerns, only has X amount of years left, that the window may be closing. I assume you disagree with that. What does that make you think?
This is my first time hearing about it. I don't try to look into it. I try my hardest to stay away from it. But we know we have an opportunity ahead of us. It may not be this year, it may not be the next year or whatever, but I know that we have one. I know I'm going to win the championship soon.
Okay.
You could do that with any of the players, right?
No.
I'm going to win a championship soon.
No, but to say that, and this is a guy that told you he was going to win the MVP, and then he won the MVP in 2011. So you hinge on to what he says. They get bounced early to the Cavaliers that season. The very next year.
When was
this? This was Media Day 2014. I asked Derrick Rose that question.
Right, okay.
So this is August 2014.
You sound so young. You sound so young.
I do sound a little older.
Yeah.
So that year they get bounced early. The next year they miss the playoffs. When is soon? I know I'm going to win a championship soon. And he said, I don't know if it's this year or next year or whatever. We're in the whatever phase.
All right, let's talk about that contract because Derrick Rose obviously played. He had spurts. We talked about it on this program where you're like, you know, quietly he's leading the team in points or he's performing at a high level and the team is just not there. As a texter for 847 just said, you know, the problem is no teamwork. You saw that where Derrick Rose would go off for 30, 35 points and yet they'd still lose by 15. But I mean, is there any way in your mind that Derrick Rose is the guy that they point the blame to, and they ship him out of town this summer?
He's not the best player on a championship team going forward because he's just physically limited. I think mentally he's a little off. He doesn't crash the rim with reckless abandon anymore, and he shouldn't because he wants to stay healthy and stay on the floor and make some money, as he's coined very famously. You know, it's about my next contract and all that. So he's playing a little bit more passive, and you understand that. That being said, you got to do something else, get somebody that's going to take this team to the next level. And they thought it was Jimmy Butler and Pau Gasol, and that answer hasn't been
concrete. Who's gone?
Concrete.
Who's gone?
Well,
is Pau Gasol gone?
Gasol is up. Noah is up. Rose is up after next year.
So that's trading deadline kind of talk when you say if this is a rebuild, they can get rid of him as a rental player.
I don't know what the plan is, Justin. That's the thing, because they told you before the year, Gar Forman said, the GM of this team said, this is a championship team.
Do they still believe that?
I mean, they can't. I mean, they
did.
But in the
postmortem, did they say that? They said, oh, this is terrible. We missed the playoffs.
No, they did nothing. They said, everybody's job is going to be, we're all going to hold everybody accountable. Uh-huh. Yeah, and then the owner sends an email, and everything kind of just, you know, they just goes to the wayside, and we forget about it. Expectations planted on this team from the get-go to where they finished, the disparity between point A and point B, is probably the worst it's ever been. Now, you can recover from that. It's not the end of the world. But, I mean, they got a slap on the wrist to get nobody fired. Nobody changes jobs.
They have weight, just from looking at the squad and looking what's out there right now. They obviously have a roster problem where they have too many power forwards. You've got Bobby Portis, who was drafted as a power forward, when you already had Pau Gasol, Joakim Noah, Taj Gibson. You know, I'm sure I'm forgetting other players.
There's
in
a couple
mix.
More
There's
power forwards forward, in there.
But Mirotić plays that position. I mean, he can swing that way. So
Mirotić plays defense like one of those revolving doors at Starbucks.
It seems to me like they just have a glut of power forwards. I mean, do you see in the offseason, you know, moving a couple of guys? Instead of just saying letting Noah walk or letting Gasol walk, can they move, put something together, package something together, and try to find a strength at maybe center or maybe point guard, something that's a little different than what they have now?
You've got to find guys that play defense. If you can't stop anybody, good luck. And a lot of times this year, you know, the point guard comes on, he gets past Rose, and then Gasol is caught on an island. I mean, there's like three guys making mistakes on every possession.
Right.
So you've got to find guys that buy in defensively, that get stops to create offense, because right now everybody's running down the floor and shooting jump shots.
Yeah.
And
works for Golden State.
Well, they make them. If you make the jump shots, it's easier.
And they do play defense on that.
When you miss the jump shots and then, you know, it's a 3-on-1 the other way.
I'm sorry I'm jumping all over.
No,
but, you know,
it's fine.
It made me think about, you know, when I think of Golden State, I think about that bench. When Steph Curry comes out of the game and Klay Thompson comes out of the game, you've got Andre Iguodala. You got guys who come in and they lead. They remind me of, what was that called? That's right, the bench mob, where they came. Remember those Thibodeau teams? It was like you felt like even Derrick Rose
Ronnie
would sit
Brewer
down and those guys would come
Kyle
in and they
Korver,
would shut it down. And
Taj
there was
Gibson,
Taj Gibson, and they had like an identity.
Kirk Heinrich.
They had an identity. It didn't seem like anyone coming off the bench.
This team doesn't have one. This team doesn't have an identity, and that was a problem all season long. They didn't know what they wanted to be, and they were caught in transition, and that happens when you change coaches and philosophies, and you go from a defensive team that wants to be the first to 90 to a guy that wants to come out and score 115, 120. the game changes, you have to adjust, and at this point in time, you cannot say that the decision is worked out. And now Tom Thibodeau gets five new shiny toys in Minnesota.
Speaking of Minnesota,
that is the team. Oh,
so
goodness.
So Tibbs is going to Minnesota. He's got amazing talent, rookie talent, which is not a good fit for the coach we know.
You think
he's not
going to
like
learned
young guys
a little bit?
But you know, I thought about this, and again, I'm no expert, and I don't have any background in salary caps and whatever. But you know, that team is missing one piece, a driving point guard. Is there any way?
Are you trying to unload Derek?
I'm saying, is there any way that Derek Rose and Coach Thibodeau could have a reunion in some sorts, and that could benefit the Chicago Bulls?
I know Tibbs would take him. I don't know if the money's going to line up. I don't know how much the Bulls would pay or expect you to pay, but that's certainly a scenario that would work. I know Tom and Derek have a good history together. I know Derek likes Tom. There's never really been a problem
there.
I
guess I could say that about any of those core players, Joakim Noah, Paul Gasol. I mean, anyone would want to go play for
Probably not Paul. Paul's more concerned with going to the opera now. Paul's cool.
Noah seemed to love.
Well, Noah can't stay on the floor. Yeah. I think Derek's going to play out the contract. I don't think he gets traded. And then at the end of the year, you've got a lot of teams with some money. Lakers.
All right.
Knicks.
I love it. Phil Jackson. And there's just, it's almost like we become fans of, I just want to see where some of these players end up and succeed, because there was some tremendous excitement around that team, the bench mob teams, the team where Derrick Rose was the MVP. And we just want to get back there. Maybe this team can't and they need to rebuild, but I do have a soft spot in my head or my heart for Taj, for Derek, for Joakim, for Ronnie Brewer.
Hey,
bring Ronnie back.
Hey, I know they're going to win a championship soon. That's what I was told. I'm a White Sox fan now. Speaking of,
let's take a break for the news. Sam, you stick around.
Oh, sure.
Let's talk about baseball, because the Cubs and Sox are not just winning their division.
They're first.
They're winning the league. They're at top of their leagues. Both of these teams are on fire. Both, I mean, Chris Sale lights out tonight, beats the Toronto Blue Jays two in a row. We'll talk about the Cubs and the Sox, the positive stories here in Chicago after the news. Stay with us.
One ball, one strike, one out, one run. That kid at the bat, and the kid's what he done. Hey, the ball in the bat, and the bat in the ball. You should have heard them fans all squall. It's gone, it's gone. This time it's really gone.
Right now in Chicago baseball, it's like the montage in The Natural when they start to win. You know, and every day, like, the newspaper circles in, and it's like, 4-1. Man, you know, like, whatever the team was, like, they beat the Indians 3-2. Like, two games out of first. That's what it's like in Chicago baseball, both sides of town. Sam Panjanovic, WGN Sports is here.
That song reminds me of The Sandlot, though. That song brought me back to childhood, running down the street with your baseball bat, with your glove over the end of the bat, and you're running to the park so you can make it there by 12 o'clock.
This is how you draw up fandom in Chicago. Both squads winning at the same time, and not just winning, you know, oh, it's nice to be 500. Both of these teams are dominating right now.
White Sox win 10-1 tonight in Toronto, 15-6, two games up on Kansas City. The Cubs currently up 4-3 on the Brewers. The Cubs are 14-5. They've got a 3.5-game lead on the Pirates. So both teams in first. I think it's more important that the White Sox got off to a strong start than anything else, because the Cubs have kind of already been through it last year. This Sox thing has been a mess for, I don't know, 4 out of 5 years now, and it's good to finally have some new players. They're having fun, and winning is contagious. Success is contagious. When you bring in guys that have won elsewhere into this new situation, new clubhouse, new guys, new manager.
I said it all along. Adam LaRoche.
It's a big deal.
Adam LaRoche was the problem.
Oh, take you and your weirdo kid, get out of my sight. I'm so tired of this guy. And then he's like, we're only going to do exclusives with Oprah.
Right.
You know?
That's what I said.
And then
even before LaRoche Gate, I was like, that's the problem right there.
He told ESPN, the magazine, well, I understand where they're coming from. No, you don't!
No,
you don't understand
you
anything.
Don't. So, but the White Sox are winning in a way that they've wanted to win for the last couple of years. Strong pitching. They're
defense.
They're finally, I mean, they made the right moves. In a weird way, and I joke with Adam LaRoche, but it opened the door for Austin Jackson, who's played a pretty great role for the White Sox defensively. They've been able to move Adam Eaton to right field and move Avi Garcia to DH, which is huge because he's not the greatest right fielder, and he wasn't last season. Todd Frazier at third base has changed the makeup of that left. Jimmy Rollins is a resurgence. So it seems like all the moves that were made in the offseason are clicking.
last year they couldn't hit. They couldn't field. They couldn't pitch. They couldn't catch.
They couldn't manage.
They couldn't throw anybody out.
Right.
The outfield defense was awful. They've fixed four, five of those areas right now. The only knock on the team as it is the team average. I mean, Frazier's at 222.
Yeah.
Jackson 219, Abreu 190. That being said, it's April. It's 40 degrees.
Right.
It's Chicago. So you would imagine that those players are going to find their grooves through May and June. They are the number one bullpen in baseball. Fielding percentage-wise, they're in the top five. And Chris Sale's 5-0. Matt Latos is 4-0.
Wow. What a start. Okay, on the other side, much higher expectations for the Chicago Cubs. I mean, obviously, that team, they've sort of been anointed at the beginning of the season as World Series favorites. They're not letting up. I mean, they had the Kyle Schwarber injury, which was something that really, like, it's just like, here comes the curse. I saw Pete or hide underneath the desk as Kyle Schwarber news came out. But I mean, they didn't miss a beat. They were able to shift some stuff. Joe Maddon's working wonders. That team just every night comes out and it feels like they're going
to
win.
You got too many good bats in that lineup, and it's hard to get all those guys out over the course of a game. I mean, they get 3-4 at bats. Eventually, they're going to take advantage of your mistake.
But I mean, I would say Jake Arrieta and John Lester. I mean, they're the best 1-2 punch in baseball right now.
Right, but they're outscoring you. They're scoring 7, 8, right. 9, 10 runs. You know,
it's great for John Lackey.
Yeah, it's good for John Lackey. Hendricks has actually been pretty solid. But yeah, Arrieta. I mean, what more can you say? And everybody that either had a take or wrote on it in a paper or a blog or whatever, well, there's no way he could do what he's doing it. He's better than he was last year. And did you see what he told reporters that people are accusing him of taking steroids?
Right, right.
And he says that is like he's flattered by that. He thinks that that's awesome that people think he's taking roids. He's not. Because they test for it.
I was going to say they test for it, and I just a curiosity. How does steroids help a pitcher?
It doesn't. It wouldn't help you
Roger
throw
Clemens,
strikes.
I guess, right?
It would add MPH on your fastball.
And that's not really his thing, though.
But well, he throws hard. But I don't want to even talk about this. He's not doing roids.
His breaking ball and the
his control.
To
he
get
doesn't
guys
walk
out
guys.
On the corner is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and his slider cutter combo with the heater with the changeup. His mechanics have been fixed. They are top of the line. And he's a fitness freak. I mean, he's drinking smoothies with turmeric in them like, you know, grandfathers do. He's just like so ahead of the curve.
Let me bring
that.
Pete Zimmerman in on this because this is a question I posed earlier. Well, he's got a nightmare. So he had a nightmare, woke him up the other day. But I posed this earlier, you know, in the carryout just about, you know, is it too early to say that Jake Arrieta may be the best pitcher in Chicago Cubs history? I mean, I'm not talking like 1920s type guys. I mean, in recent history from Fergie Jenkins on.
I mean, two no-hitters. That's pretty, I mean, you know, got Mil Pappas, you know, God rest his soul,
starts,
you know,
right.
Just passed away last week.
Right.
You know, but he wasn't a Cub for his entire career. I guess neither was Arrieta, but I don't know.
I mean, as a Cubs fan, as a diehard, I mean, just think of it as Arrieta up there with, and forget about stats, just think about just the heart, the feel.
You think
up there
of
with Greg Maddux and Rick Sutcliffe,
Fergie
at this point?
Jenkins, possibly?
Maybe I don't know. Not yet.
Really?
I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean Sutcliffe had 1 year on the Cubs that was really that,
yeah,
the half a year,
16-1,
and then he never really was able to replicate that. And Fergie Jenkins, I mean his career was tremendous, you know, and you never saw him do the kind of things that Arrieta's doing on the mound right now.
And the two guys that were planned to be the Hall of Famers. I mean, they thought they had the 1-2 punch for 10, 15 years when they had Wood and Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those were supposed to be the guys, not to bring that up, but that was supposed to be, you know, the core of guys that finally got a World Series. Those two were supposed to be on the mound for games 1 and 2, and it just didn't work out.
Now, it may be premature. Obviously, we're sports talking here and the idea of what Jake Arrieta's career, because he's, you know, if he wins a World Series, it's no doubt he's the best pitcher in Cubs
ever.
History. But, but obviously, his over the last 24 starts, I mean, it's baseball legend, not just Cubs legend. It's baseball. I've never seen anything like it.
Better than Bob Gibson.
He hasn't lost at Wrigley since June of 2015. And the game that he was it,
that's amazing.
Was it? Yeah, it was 15. And the game he lost, the Phillies, Cole Hamels threw a no-hitter.
Right.
So that it took a no hitter to beat him.
Well, let's wrap on the your nightmare scenario.
Sure.
Yeah, we were on.
He's scratching his face.
I know. I just get the just thinking about it. We were in Mexico last week for vacation, and it was really hard to get any type of internet or whatever. But I checked my phone, and I saw Jake Arrieta pitching the no hitter. I'm like, oh, got to tune in. So clicked on Sirius to listen to the game. And it's really funny because the internet would go out and you don't really realize in baseball because there's long pauses.
Right.
So you're sitting there for like 2 minutes. Right. Wait a minute. What's going on? Going to bed all excited. Arrieta pitches the no-hitter, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, like 3 or 4 in the morning, wake up in the sweat. And I had the dream that the Cubs are going to go all the way, make it to the World Series, and then lose to the White Sox.
That's
and it's possible.
At this point, I mean, the it's only been 20 games. I love Chicago. I love this town.
Cold sweat in Mexico on vacation.
We're 20 games in, and the Kansas City Royals are so quiet. It's the quietest team in baseball history where they're like, they're at the same rate, and nobody's talking about the defending World Series champs. They're what, a game back to the White Sox?
I think it's 2 now. By the way, I know we're going to get moving here, but I don't know how much Hawk Harrelson you've watched or seen.
I haven't.
We haven't had this conversation. Opening series in Oakland, some Oakland guy smokes a ball to deep. Like, this ball is crushed, 450 feet. And Hawk's like, there's a can of corn. And it's gone.
It's gone, oh.
And I literally, I thought I had too many vodkas. I thought there's no way he just said that.
Is that just homerism on his part where he's like, he won't recognize a
home run
ball?
This ball landed 10 rows up in the upper deck. Hawk, all right, say what you want about Hawk. Hawk can't see anymore. He can't see. Candy corn?
No, I like that. I think it's more. I think it's strategic. I think it's mental.
It's
he's
awesome.
Playing mental games with the Oakland fans.
Can of corn.
Oh,
4:30.
I was wrong. Home run. That's great. All right, Sam Penjanovic, good to see you, buddy. Thanks for talking Chicago sports. Huge, huge time. Obviously, it's going to be baseball specific, but we've got the NFL draft. We didn't even talk about the Bears. We'll talk about that later this week. Good to see you, buddy.
You got it.
Tell me about your vacation. I'd really like to know. I'll bet you went somewhere special. I'll bet you went somewhere nice. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Tell me about your vacation. Pete Zimmerman and myself, we went on vacation last week. We kind of synced it up. We didn't go to the same place. We're not like Roz and Frasier. Pete's not at my house whenever we're not on the air. But we did take the time to take vacation at the same time. It's a special vacation for you, correct?
That's right. My honeymoon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you go? Let me back up. Tell me about your vacation.
We went to Tulum, which is a town about 90 minutes south of Cancun. Mm. Small little resort town. Beautiful. Highly recommend.
Easy to get to? Like, how do you fly in?
You fly into Cancun, and then you take a shuttle, or, we had rented a car, or got a car and drove to 90 minutes. Great.
And is Great. It all, was it all-inclusive? Like, that's the idea?
It's a little bit different. Like, Cancun, there's a lot of yahoos in Cancun, what I mean? We're drinking drinks with, the bones
right.
and stuff, and...
That sounds great, honeymoon. That sounds like a great honeymoon.
This is a little bit more boutique-y, where it's just like a mile stretch, and like the hotels are small. Like our hotel is like maybe 9 rooms and such like that, just right on the beach. And then all the guys kind of look like Marnie's ex-boyfriend on Girls, like that type of look. They all like they're from Brooklyn.
Okay, great.
That type of scene.
Marnie's ex-boyfriend from Girls. Got it. Check. That's a type.
But it's beautiful there. We were on the plane. We saw your friend Steve Dolinsky going to the same area.
Yeah, he's going to be on. We'll ask him about it. He's going to be on the show on Friday.
Beautiful. Highly recommended.
So it was a good time. I mean, what did you eat?
We ate a lot. Let me think. They surprisingly went to an Italian restaurant, Posada Margherita. Amazing. Some of the best pasta I've ever had. Went to a place called Sonara, which is right next to our hotel. Had a wonderful breakfast. Avocado toast. Oh. It's a must.
And so is pretty much the days just lounging on the beach or lounging at the pool? How does it work?
Yeah, it's near the ruins where, Justin Bieber pulled down his pants.
Sure, of course. The Bieber ruins.
And there's some cenotes you can swim in. But, yeah, we just kind of woke up. Molly did some yoga. I went for a little run. We'd meet back and then just kind of sit at the beach and read until dinner time.
Wow.
Have a couple of cocktails.
That's great, man.
I was reading the new Replacements book. It's like 600 pages. Another great recommendation. But so every conversation we have now is like, so in this Replacements book,
right,
book.
Right.
And Molly is like, finally, she's like, let me guess, they were drunk. Because every story about that book is they were horribly drunk.
Is it an autobiography or is it
a biography? Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a great vacation.
It was.
Thanks for telling me about it. Pete Zimmerman, Tulum.
Mm-hmm.
And you recommend it.
Highly recommend it.
There you go. 312-981-7200. Tell me about your vacation. 312-981-7200. We'll get Rob's vacation. We'll get Esmeralda's vacation.
Lovely.
Talk about my vacation. Tell me about your vacation. All right, it's back here in the download on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tell me about your vacation. Rob Martyr, I want to start with you. Tell me about your vacation.
Oh, man, so many to choose from, so many highlights, so many memories. Justin, you and I have children.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to say that any vacation without the kids, as much as we love our children, is a great vacation.
That's true.
So I'm going to pick the trip that Melissa and I took to Hawaii after she and I finally got married. We had our kids first, bought the house, and then decided to finally officially tie the knot, going on about 3 years now. So we went to the big island of Hawaii. It was great. We just relaxed. We had cocktails by the pool. The hotel was on the ocean. Took a day trip and did the perimeter of the big island of Hawaii,
wow,
which was fantastic. Went up the side of Mount Kilauea, which was beautiful. So we had a great time.
Did you go all-inclusive, or do you do when you go to something like Hala?
We did kind of an a la carte thing, and it was nice because even though you wouldn't think it, but the Big Island, there's not a whole lot to do. It's really not all that touristy.
Mm-hmm.
But there was kind of a little promenade, kind of shops and whatnot. So we would get up early every morning and go, get provisions and bring stuff back to our room. And so it was nice.
Are you the kind of vacationer who likes to plan things out that you're like, okay, we've got to squeeze all this stuff in? Or are you the kind of person who you and your wife are just like, well, let's just wing it?
It depends. That vacation we were winging it, but when we've gone to Disney, and we're going to go back again this year as well, we plan everything out because you've got the fast passes, you've got you've got that, and she coordinates all that. So
are you? When I've gone to Disney in the past, I've been the dad who's like, okay, the best thing is we start in Tomorrowland, and we're going to crisscross over to Frontierland, then we're going to make a crisscross back to and the best time is going to be here, and then by the end, I'm going to hit every ride. Get in line. Let's go.
Yeah, I got to tell you, last year I got to give Melissa all the credit because she basically coordinated all of our fast passes.
Mm-hmm.
So you get like three a day, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we basically coordinated everything around our fast passes. So whatever we happened to be near, once we were done with our fast pass attraction, we'd be like, oh, well, let's go over here and do this. So
it's imperative. You got to do it.
So yeah. Is fast pass, that's like a cheater way to, not a cheater way, but like you get in front of the line?
It's like you actually schedule when you're going to be at the ride.
Ah.
So they only earmark certain amount of fast passes for a particular time frame. So you say, well, I'm going to go to the Tower of Terror, at 12:30.
Right.
So if you've got your fast pass for that time at the Tower of Terror, you're not going to wait in line all that long.
Nice.
Yeah, you skip to like they don't let you skip right to the ride.
But you skip
the long winding.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And as you're going through the fast pass line, everybody else that's the great unwashed that are waiting in the other line, you feel kind of like a VIP. You're walking along. You're going, hey man,
hey,
how you doing?
Hey, is that Rob Martyr?
What's going on?
That's Rob Martyr.
Yeah. See, we're fast passing this ride.
And then they go, that's Rob Martyr, Dad. Elitist. That guy
radio
thinks he can cut in
radio
line.
Guy.
Radio guy.
Making the big bucks.
You suck, Martyr. Get out of my spot.
Your newscasts are terrible.
Well, that sounds like a good vacation. Yeah. Now you get to Hawaii and you got the Fast Pass at Disney. Esmeralda, tell me about your vacation.
About 3 years ago, I went to Merida.
Oh.
Or, well, I went to a city next to Merida, and this is the other side of the Yucatan Peninsula, so it's on the other side of Cancun. Sleepy town called Chelem. Gorgeous. I rented a house with six friends.
Wow, friend vacation. Yeah, you gotta love that.
Yes, and we just sat in a pool, drank margaritas.
Is that hard? Beer. Is that a friend vacation like that? Is that harder or easier to plan because everyone's committed to it, or is it just too many cooks?
Well, we were pretty chill. So there were six of us. Two of the six were a couple.
Hmm.
There was another couple, but they were chill. The other couple, though, they were like, we need to do... They drove from Cancun across the peninsula to Cancun, or to Merida, and the entire time they stopped it here, they went to there, they did
right.
this, and then once they got to where we were, they were like, we need to go here and do this and do that, and just... I remember one day we were supposed to meet up with them, and I was like, you know what? It's really hot out. Let's just hang out by the pool.
When you have them,
and everyone
people,
decided, yeah. they're like, yeah.
Is no. there, I mean, do you have to, does it, is there kind of like a groupthink mentality that takes over? Like, we're all going to hang at the pool, or can you split off?
We could have split off, but we, for the most part, other than that couple, we were all in agreement of everything.
Yeah, nobody wants to, right?
Like, we were going to go, and then I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to sit this out. It's hot out. And then they were all like, yeah, no,
great.
Let's all sit out.
That sounds wonderful. So, like, six friends going to vacation,
yeah,
renting
it was
a house,
fun.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, we went there, and then Merida is the biggest town next to where we were, and it's gorgeous. It's a lot of European-looking architecture.
Do you feel at all... a pressure to be a site like to sightsee, to go and check stuff out and not just sort of hang out by the pool?
Well, yes and no. I mean, that town was very pretty. So just having to just go there and go, let's go get dinner and let's go do this and that. You're just walking through the streets,
right?
And you're already sightseeing because everything around there is just so pretty. The little town we were in, there really wasn't much to look at.
No, so there wasn't options, yeah.
Right. It was just more to, let's just hang out by this pool
now,
and soak up sun.
You rented a house.
Yes.
So you were kind of on your own when it comes to food and booze?
We were, but there was, again, there was like little restaurants and stuff. Yeah, the only problem was everything would close at about 4 or 5 because people eat really early in Mexico for the most part, like in the smaller towns. That's kind
But you'd
of
have
the,
to stack up, right, at the
yeah,
house?
We would.
Like, you'd have to, like, was there any, like...
I ate a lot of quesadillas because we bought like freshly made tortillas and they were just delicious. I don't like flour tortillas, but these things were so good. They were these thin, tiny little tortillas, so I just kept making myself quesadillas.
Was everybody in a situation like that? Is everybody in charge of their own meal, or do you guys do big meals at the house, or that?
No,
kind of-
we had made some meals, and then we also it's a bit of an expat town. So we unfortunately had to eat, they had a taco night. We had to eat like Taco Bell style tacos one night because we were like,
wow.
It's late and we don't have food and we're hungry.
I love it. All right. Esmeralda, that sounds good. How long did you stay?
We were there a week.
Was it
in October.
Appropriate amount of time, a week?
Yeah,
yeah?
I didn't want to kill anybody.
That's what it feels like if you go to like day eight.
Yeah, that made me realize. I'm like, I could go on vacation with you guys again. I do
right.
not want to kill any of you.
If you go longer, I mean, that's the sort of thing. Like I always have, whenever we go to Las Vegas, you really
no, you
gotta
go a weekend,
watch.
That's
you
it.
Gotta watch. If you go more than 3 days, you're really starting to play with fire.
Yeah, I've gone there for a week.
Oh,
we ran. By the end, I was I just didn't want to be there anymore.
Right, you just get tired. It's the. I don't know if it's like the. What do you call it?
Well, it's just one big suburb.
Yeah.
So if you run out of just money and wanting to not gamble, there's not much else.
Oh, the flow of the city. Like, it's a pace. And at a certain point, you're like, I'm just so sick of this pace. And you're right, especially like if you don't have money or if you're like, I don't want to do the same thing. I don't want to go indoors and hear ding 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 ding.
Yeah, I don't want to drink and gamble.
Right.
If you don't want to do that, there's nothing there to do.
Although, I have a friend who told me, no, everybody now is EDM clubs. You
See,
go in
no.
there now, everybody
oh.
just goes to those clubs. But I'm like, wait, maybe it's the old man in me, but I'm like, I always liked Vegas because there was a chance you could win your money back or drink for free at the table. So I was always like balancing, like that gin and tonic would be like $8. So, you know, at least I'm making some money back in value. But an EDM club, I mean, you're paying like for bottle service and everything you would do in a regular club. So you're just dropping thousands
exactly.
of dollars. So
and
I don't understand the value.
It's more money because you're in Vegas.
Right. So I don't understand the value in that at all. That's it's kind of the same concept of strip clubs. Like, I don't understand, like, when anyone in Vegas would want to do that and be like, oh, man, it was a great time. I spent $1,500.
It's like you just gambled your money
right.
without even playing.
Yeah, exactly.
You just gave it to him. Went, here you go. Bye.
I'm like, wait, I don't get a free drink with
nope.
this EDM club? No. No thanks. Not doing it. All right. So 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. Tell me about your vacation. I love this. I could do this for like 6 hours. I just want to hear about everybody's vacation. Because it's, I mean, now I'm like, I'm interested. I'm like, oh, a friend vacation, rent a house.
It was it was $600.
It was $600
for
the week?
Six people.
Wow.
So we only
paid
$100.
That's a great idea. I did that same thing and it was not $600. And it was only probably about 4 days in Tahoe one time. Mm-hmm. And that was with friends and it was a nice trip, but that was way more expensive than $600.
Well, it was a sleepy little town.
Tahoe's a good town. I mean, you go in the summertime. If you go in the wintertime, it's like through the roof because it's a ski town.
Right.
And everyone's there. So the Airbnbs and everything there, you're just like, oh my God. And when you go to Tahoe, especially South Tahoe, where Nevada and California kind of split right there, it's all Airbnbs. Like it's houses that were built for that. It's all because it's ski town, because the idea that you stay there for a week and everything is set up for that. So in the summer, they're eating their shirt because nobody's there. So if you go in the summertime, you get better deals for a house. But still, I think that we did maybe 4 days for like maybe $1,200 or something like that. Like it was a lot at the end of the day, but it was a house. It was a full house and there were like six or seven guys. So anyway, we'll continue. Tell me about your vacation. 312-981-7200. Talk about my vacation, which we just got back from Northern California. When we come back, stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez takes over with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. Sanaa, tell me about your vacation.
Hi, I was a contestant on Wheel of Fortune. So
what?
Yeah.
How was that? Yeah. How did you get that? That's great. That's a great start to this vacation.
Well, it started just by watching it. My mom and I, we love watching Wheel of Fortune. And one night we were watching it, my husband was like, you need to go on. And I was like, So I sent an email, and they sent something back asking me to do a video. And I did the video. And they sent something back asking me to audition. And I did. The auditions were downtown Chicago. And there were about 120 people in my session. And subhanAllah, I got down to the last seven. And they told us in about 2 weeks, you know, you should hear something. And 2 weeks came, I heard nothing. So I waited another week and told my mom, I don't think it's going to happen. Well, about 5 weeks later, I got a letter. Congratulations!
Come on out. Pat Sajak wants to meet you.
Yes, absolutely. I was so excited.
So you get to come out to L.A. to do the show, and then it's essentially a little bit of a vacation.
Yes, I was able to do that. So they taped the show, and I just took some extra days and cruised California, got to walk the streets and see all the things, and it was just nice. I stayed about 4 extra days.
So how was it? Had you been to Los Angeles before?
No, that was actually my first time, and I didn't know it, but I have a cousin, a freaky boy, who lived there. So he kind of took me around and showed me the things and ins and outs, and it was great. Yeah.
So did you stay with your cousin or did you stay in a hotel?
I did not. I stayed at a hotel. The show, you know, has a hotel.
Oh, they put you up, yeah.
Yeah, so I stayed there and stayed for a couple days extra. And it was really nice because, you know, I'm Muslim, so I was really concerned about a lot of things associated with the show. And when I came there, you know, the producers, they call you and
they, you know, get to know you a little bit. And I explained to them, you know, that I was Muslim and certain things I needed. So, and when I got there, they were like, Sanaa, Sanaa. And I'm all like, hey, that's me. He's like, hey, here's a little area for you to make prayer. And I'm like, wow. You know?
Oh, that's great. That's great. The Wheel of Fortune's accommodating. That's great.
They went above and beyond. I was so grateful, so humble, so apostolic.
All right, so the big question is, did you win?
Well, I hope everybody's a winner, baby. No, I was third place, and I brought home $5,000.
All right, so now that's that. Now that is how you do it. You go on vacation and you come back with money.
Yeah.
Good work. Sanaa, thanks for sharing your story. Thanks for telling me about your vacation.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
There you go. That's a good one. That's a good vacation when you actually make money.
Oh, yeah.
On a vacation.
Wheel of Fortune.
Wheel of Fortune. That's good. L.A. too. And I would assume that there's enough to do in Los Angeles that would make for a good vacation.
Oh, yeah.
Because especially if you haven't been there before, you can go to Sunset Boulevard. You can go to... You know, all sorts of Hollywood type stuff.
Yeah.
You can also get up into the mountains there, right around that area. I went to Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother lives in Modesto, California. So we flew into Oakland. And then we rented a van. It took forever. At the one person at the Oakland Dollar Rental, there was like 9 people in line. And have you rented a car from the Oakland Dollar Rental?
No, maybe? I haven't. But generally, I think... rent a cars at the airport area seemed to be
nightmare. They asked 55 questions, and every time you're like, your knee jerk is move along, there's 8 people breathing down my neck, you know. Then you're like, wait, do I need that?
Yeah,
do I need what insurance?
You always think they're upselling on the insurance things, and then you're
worried.
A ton
of tolls. There was a ton on tolls because in the Bay Area, it's every bridge is tolled, and so they're like, do you want a pass for $60 for the week? And I'm like, no. Do I want that? I don't know what I need. So anyway, we got to Modesto, which is like probably an hour and a half. So you go through like the mountains right outside of Oakland going east. But then you flatten off. The valley of the sort of north central California valley is farm. It's all agriculture. And it's a lot like Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is no sort of like rolling hills, mountains. It is farmland. And so you're out there, and it's you know, that's a big thing. Gallo Wines is the big, like, they support the town. That's the big thing because they do a ton of wining there. And they own a ton of brands, and Gallo, of course. So that's, like, really the backbone. And also Foster Farms Chicken. So those are the two companies, and they just run that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a great time. I mean, it was really hot there, which was great. But I got to visit my brother, who I haven't seen since he left Chicago in January. So it's been nice to see him. And then, but I made 3 trips out of it. So I was able to go to Yosemite, which is like 2 hours probably east of there.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to drive through the mountains. So I took my minivan because I had my parents with me, my son, Josh, and you know my brother, and. You, essentially, Google Maps is like, you know, that's how you do it now. You're just Google Maps, where it's the fastest way, mm-hmm. to Yosemite. And they're like, fastest is right that way, straight ahead. But it's a route that takes you like on the roads with no guardrails around the mountains. Yeah. And I mean, you're getting up there, man. And I don't know about you, but I'm not a huge minivan driver. Like, it's not really, I don't have a lot of experience with the bigger vans. So I'm in this minivan going up, and every time you make a turn and you're like, don't look down.
I'm so nervous.
You got to go up even further and up even further. I mean, I'm thousands of miles up. Like, it just felt like that.
You're
just,
yeah.
Like, and everyone in the van, it doesn't help because they're like, wow, look at that view. And I'm like, shut up.
I know. You can't even, you're just like looking like straight. You can't
like
even.
My heart right now is
your
still
eyes.
Like beating from it. And then, and the other way going down, like, cause you know, we go to Yosemite, which is beautiful. Beautiful country. If you ever get a chance to go there, it's unreal. Like the scenery, it's untouched. It's really great. Our tour driver took like a tram. The tour driver was like really into rock climbing. So it was all about rock climbing. And I'm like, I don't want to rock climb. I just want to look at this stuff. And his favorite is like, that right there is the nose. Warren Harding came here and he scaled that nose back in 1933 at a part. And I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And then he goes, and I swear, like maybe 10 minutes later, he goes, President Warren Harding made this a landmark, a different Warren Harding than the man who scaled the mountain. I'm like, like, what do you, like, I was like, you're terrible storyteller. You just, how did you, I, you, everyone thought that, ah, there's two Warren Hardings? Yeah, Warren Harding, the rock climber, man. It's like, all right. So anyway, coming back, going down the hill, it's even worse because you can't control your speed. You're always on the brake.
No, yeah.
And then you're making the turn as people are coming up. So you're like, you're almost like blindly making turns around these winding roads. And then on the right side is just the rock formation. There's nothing. There's no like shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't build these with shoulders.
No.
So you're just like, oh, you can't get too close because you'll hit the car on the side. It was like, but white, I did it.
White knuckling. Yeah, those I hate. Ugh.
Yeah. So we did Yosemite, and then we did on the other side San Francisco and Monterey, which is unbelievable territory as well. So it was
Alcatraz?
A great vacation. We did. We went out on the boat. I took my son past the Golden Gate Bridge on the Bay Tour. It's like a 45-minute where you go past the homeless seals right there. It's like, and you're like, all right, I get it. You're like, I get it. And then you roll all the way around the bridge, you go back down, and then you go past Alcatraz.
Were they painting the bridge?
They were not painting the bridge. The bridge was already painted.
Hmm.
But the bridge in, like I drove into San Francisco. This is a whole other show, and we got to go because it's time for Patty's show. But drove into San Francisco, decided to continue to drive because I'm from Chicago, meaning I was going to park it and then Uber or figure it out.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know what, man, I'm my brother's car. I'm like, I'm not intimidated by you, San Francisco. I drove that thing, bam, found the full house, bam.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, did all the stuff, parked right in front. Like, I knew what I was up to. Went to Chinatown, turned the wheel towards the mountain, you know, or to the hill, turned it away when I was going up, man. I was on fire. I'm like, this ain't no town. From Chicago. Well, that's going to do it tonight. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. We're back tomorrow with Dorothy Farrell. She is the 89/90-year-old woman who is the number one Cubs fan. She sits behind the visitor's dugout. You recognize her if you're a Cubs fan. She was out at the ballpark tonight, does the YMCA. Well, there's a petition going around to get her to sing the seventh inning stretch, so she'll be my guest tomorrow at the big table. All right, Patty Vasquez up next.